Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Bite Night Picks with your hosts, Frank
and Matt
Allen. And just like that, we're back with Fight Night Picks, getting set for UFC Fight Night, Lewis versus Spivak. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen, Twitter and Instagram, at Craig Allen FNP. I wanted to model my look after Li Jingliang at the fight.
Looking good.
I went Canadian tuxedo with the Fight Night Picks shirt underneath. With me, as always, Matt Allen, respective socials, Matt Allen FNP. And Matt Allen, we kind of touched on this card
quite a
bit.
Good job last week.
Well, last week with UFC 281, we both went 11-3. We'll get that one out of the way right now. Some nice underdog picks on that card. And of course, who got that main event right? There's not a lot
just
of you that did.
Just an incredible event.
But I'm sure we'll hear from you in the comments section. A great win for Alex Pereira, winning the belt. Both challengers winning the belts as well. Zhang Weili victorious. But we touched a lot on the sidekick with Fight Night Picks on this card, talking about just how good it was, how full of depth it is. And when we were just like behind the curtain, breaking the fourth wall, when we were coming up with Fight of the Night, like there are quite a few different picks you could have. You look at this card in general, there's only three ranked fighters, Derek Lewis, Sergey Spivak, in that main event. The UFC did a great job with that poster. And then buried on the prelims, former title challenger Jennifer Maia is ranked, taking on Ukraine's Marina Moroz, the Playboy centerfold.
And that's Marina what I really Rose. Like about this card. It might not have the star value that some other Fight Night cards have, but let's be honest, the Fight Night cards haven't been all that deep lately. I feel like the pay-per-views have more than delivered, if we're being honest. Like, to the UFC's credit, it's not like they're just putting on nothing but bad shows. Like, the pay-per-views have been very stacked top to bottom, but the Fight Night cards have been a little light. But what I like about this one is the matchmaking's great. There's a lot of fights you can get really excited about just because they are so close. You can make such a compelling argument either way.
Yeah, and if you do look at it, I mean, Fight Matrix is kind of the one that we gauge the bar on. In the last two big pay-per-view cards over there, they scored them both 4.5 out of 5 stars, and that takes a lot from those folks with their grading system. This card, they have it at a 2.5 star. Bellator that you have coming up on the weekend, it's the rematch between Beast and 25-8 and Vadim Nemkov. That's a 2 out of 5. But I like their card quite a bit because there are a lot of fun fights. Usman Nurmagomedov's on that card as well. But when we do focus in on this one, debut of Czech star. I'm going to say star. Teresa Bleda. You have second times out for Natalia Silva, Brady Heastan, Fernie Garcia, Charles Johnson, and Waldo Cortez Acosta. Matt, we're amped up about the card. We're going to throw it on over to our Fight of the Night screen. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have in that Fight of the Night screen. It's time to break those ones down. 13 fights, you're not wrong, till Saturday night.
Let us know down below in the comment section who you've got. It's time for the Fight of the Night with Fight Night Picks.
All right, so first pick for a possible Fight of the Night, Andrea Fialho taking on Muslim Salikov. And when you look at it for Salikov coming into the UFC, a lot was expected. He had 4 spinning knockout wins in a row, and the last one was
Melvin Gallard.
Melvin Gallard, who was also Israel Adesanya's kind of springboard into the UFC.
But he didn't regardless, take easy fights, Craig.
Salikov lost his UFC debut, and from there, you kind of wondered what was going to happen. He then finished Ricky Rainey, finished Nordin Taleb, and off to the races. But he's such a specialist in striking, who's incorporated grappling into his game, that's what makes this fight very, very important and interesting. When you're taking on a guy like Andrea Fialho, who's kind of been shot out of a cannon to start his UFC career.
Oh yeah, Fialho, no matter who he fights in the UFC, you think there's a good chance he's going to be nominated for a Fight of the Night. His aggressive type of strike-first style is going to be fun. He could fight, I don't know, a box full of pool noodles. It would probably be a phenomenal fight. His fighting style has always been catered that way, and even his last loss against Jake Matthews, I genuinely think people forget how good Jake Matthews is as a mixed martial artist. I know he doesn't fight all that often, and he never maybe reached the hype that he was once supposed to, but still, you can't just lose to Jake Matthews and have people forget about you. I think for Fialho, he can go out there and have a lot of interesting matchups with a lot of those other action-type fighters in this weight class. This fight against Salikov will be interesting, though, because what version of him will we get? Is he still going to be that all-gas, no-breaks type of fighter? Because Salikov is a better fighter when you come towards him, but if you're a little bit patient, we have seen Salikov will kind of come out of his shell a little bit, and I could see Fialho having a lot of success if he waits for Salikov to kind of make that first
move. This is one of those fights that if you and I could just matchmake for the UFC for a day, we throw that one together. This one, we probably wouldn't have thrown it together, but I still do think it's going to be a good fight. Way back in 2018 when Fight Night Picks started and it was a little podcast show and we were doing a little bit on YouTube and it was me, I said Danny Roberts is going to have a fight of the night with David Zavada, and I felt like I was just an alien on some strange planet, but sure as shit, that ended up as a fight of the night. And David Zavada is no longer in the UFC, but for Danny Roberts, 7-5 with the company, taking on the younger man in Jack Della Maddalena, a guy who's had two quick first-round knockouts in his two lone UFC fights. But if you go back and you watch Jack Della really perform on the regional scene with Eternal, where he was the champ, or his fight against Ange Lusa over on Dana White's Contender Series, you know he can put on a fight of the night and not just be a one-hitter, quitter, one-round type of guy. So I think these guys are going to give one to take one, slug it out, and I think it's going to be a really good fight.
And the great thing about Danny Roberts is he's a great test for any prospect really trying to make a name for themselves. And he's not one of those fighters that, let's be honest, there's guys out there that when they do fight those upper echelon prospects, you kind of just assume they're going to lose. Danny Roberts isn't that whatsoever. He is a great sort of speed bump for these fighters because, okay, if you beat Danny Roberts, similar to Chris Gutierrez beating Frank Yeager last weekend, you beat a guy like that, great things are going to happen to you. I know Danny Roberts isn't on the level of a guy like Frank Yeager, but you get it. When you beat a guy like Danny Roberts, then you start fighting only very difficult fights from that point on. And I think Jack Della Maddalena is ready for that point in his career. So I'm really excited for this fight. I do think Danny Roberts is going to be a tough test for Maddalena.
Danny Roberts, I mean, he's a guy that has two fight of the nights actually on his ledger, one against Dominique Steele way back when, and of course that aforementioned fight against David Zavada. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have as a fight of the night contender. If you say Miles Johns, Vince Morales, I'll give you a heart on that post. So some big time fights coming up in this card for sure. So a little bit of housekeeping before we move right into this. 13 total fights on the card. Again, only 3 ranked fighters, but it's not necessarily based off of that. You have those newcomers, those second times out. Teresa Bleda, very good prospect, but oh, by the way, her opponent, Natalia Silva, blew the socks off of everybody that watched that fight. Nobody thought Natalia Silva was ever going to look like that after over 2 years away, after a broken ulna. We have so much to talk about with all of these fights. Lewis taking on Spivak. The promotion's going to spell it Sergey, H-E-I, Spivak with a C. But Sergey spells it S-E-R-G-E-Y-S-P-I-V-A-K. V-A-K over on his Instagram. So we're going to spell it the way that Sergey spells it himself. We'll let the UFC do their own thing. They run the promotion. But Matt, I know, again, you're really excited about this one. The co-main event, a little bit of a head-scratcher. Iwan Kutsalaba taking on Kennedy and Zechiku. But again, a very, very well laid out card.
What I really enjoy about this main event is it does reflect the first two cards on last weekend's pay-per-view. It was, hey, you have the more proven guy in Derek Lewis, who, again, I kind of made this joke during our fight companion. Derek Lewis has fought everyone in the top 15. He's beaten the majority of them. He's lost to some of them. But at this point, we know what we know about Derek Lewis. We love him for the reasons we love him, and we know what his weaknesses are going to be. But for Spivak, he has had some losses earlier on in his career, but he's been able to regather himself and become a very dangerous fighter in this division. And again, Derek Lewis is one of those guys, so if you beat him, the challenges just keep on getting more and more difficult. And for Lewis, this might be his last chance to be one of those kind of, oh, we need a main event slot filled, let's get Derek Lewis on the phone. For Lewis, he's had these opportunities quite a bit, and he has come up short as of late, so you wonder how many more chances he's going to get in a 5-round atmosphere. So I think Lewis is going to be more than motivated to go out there and try to get the win over the much younger Spivak.
And he fights pretty damn well at the UFC's Apex. We'll talk about that in that main event preview and prediction. Thanks so much for tuning in with Fight Night Picks. You guys made UFC 281 Fight Week very, very great. And listen, we've got question mark kicks 2 hours before the prelims. That's an early show coming up this Saturday. Make sure you tune in for that. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. I've always wanted to start one of our videos off this way, and I feel like we should get Mike Goldberg on the channel at some point. But coming up next, we have Natalia Silva representing Brazil. She's taking on the UFC debutante. It is Teresa Bleda out of Czechia, the Czech Republic's own. Bleda is a big-time up-and-comer that really need to know about. And if you're talking about really hot prospects in this division, she is definitely a fighter that you have to pay attention to. Already at 20 years of age, undefeated as a pro, undefeated as an amateur, some really nice amateur wins on her record. The former Octagon flyweight champ, time at bantamweight, time at flyweight on her ledger. But if we do consider this, she came in on Dana White's Contender Series this past summer. She took on Nayara Maia, And Craig and Matt Allen happened to have a show.
We did.
Previewing Dana White's Contender Series. So what we're going to do for you folks, we're going to throw it on back to our preview for Teresa Bleda going on Contender Series. We're going to update you with the fight that she had and then really hammer home a couple of points about these two women who now, both of them, have really, really bright prospects and futures in this division. So we'll throw it on back to that preview and then we'll really get back to those details. Well, we will kick it off, Matt, with the first fight that is on this card. And we have Teresa Bleda taking on, and this is going to be a fun one, Nayara Maya. But if you go out and you do the tape study and you try and watch her fights, it's not Nayara Maya. It's Nayara Arnaud. So that's who you're going to be looking for if you're trying to watch tape on her. But if we focus on Bleda just to start, I mean, Matt, for the Czech native, she's been all the hotness for as long as she's been in MMA.
Definitely.
Undefeated as an amateur. She went 6-0 over there. 5-0 already as a pro. And for Bleda, Matt, we talked about her a couple of weeks ago with Lucia Pudzilova coming back into the UFC because Pudzilova was in an octagon tournament in 2020. And she lost to a 19-year-old Bleda.
Isn't that wild?
It is. And the craziest part about it is, and I know a lot of people focused on it, well, nobody knew what the rules of the tournament were. Octagon threw it on just to kind of get some people some combat experience, get them moving at the height of the pandemic, which is all fair. But Bleda had a lot of success in that one fight. I was overly critical of it in the Pudzilova prediction for Wu Yannan. But when I do focus in on for Teresa Bleda, I love the level of competition that she's faced throughout this run. I know her nickname on Tapology is considered Ronda. I read a couple of interviews, one by Extra.cz, another one by Top Fight CZ. So over in Chechia, that's where they're doing those interviews. And she said, that used to be my nickname when I was an amateur. They kind of gave it to me on the way up, but don't have a nickname right now. Not going to go by that moniker. But if you do watch her fight, she doesn't really fight like Ronda Rousey. She is a wrestler for sure, but she's not going for a lot of upper body throws. She's not a judo player. She's going to run in, try and grab a double leg, and she really does have great entries on those takedowns. So you love to see it. Very high level for a very, very young fighter. But again, I consider this. She's 20 years old. She does have some very good experience. The fights that I really like to hone in on, the fight against Martins. Martins wasn't just some Brazilian fighter that they bring over to Europe and, hey, you beat a Brazilian, you're going to be the champion. She fights Martins and has a little bit of a hard time. Every time she goes in to close the gap, Martins goes in to pull guillotine. A couple of them were very tight, round one, round two. But if you look at it, Bleda is able to kind of keep position, keep pace, and then get out of it and spend meaningful amount of time on top. Her fight where she won the belt over with Octagon, the flyweight belt, was against Mabelle Lima, who's on Dana White's Contender Series in the past. And in that fight, well, she looked amazing, but also looked like a weight class bigger. And that's the other thing for Bleda. She also has bantamweight experience as a pro and as an amateur. She's a very big flyweight.
She is, and she does use it to her advantage. She's like a wet blanket on top of a lot of fighters when she is able to get that position. And you're right, she's an intelligent grappler, and she shows the ability to fight out of tough situations and then make it dominant for herself again. The problem is, I do think Bleda just is a higher level grappler. I think these fighters are very similar. I just think Bleda has her sliders turned up, maybe not even 10% more, maybe even 20% more. I do like her style of grappling towards MMA a lot more, because here's the thing. With Maya, she can finish with submissions, don't get me wrong, but I worry about her losing a lot of the minutes and a lot of the moments in between those bigger actions. And with Bleda, at least I do like her top control a little bit more, so we're okay. Let's say it doesn't end in a finish. Neither fighter is able to get a submission. The judges are probably going to reward Bleda for a lot of her top control and her grappling other than Maya.
Alright, so you look at it for Bleda. She came in on week number 7, Dana White's Contender Series this past summer, taking on Nayara Maya, a fighter who had, listen, great experience to her credit.
Oh,
she's
yeah.
A Novo Nyao fighter. She really is somebody that's going to try and grapple with you. You looked at some of her previous wins. She really was a submission threat. And the thing that I found weird going back and watching Bleda when she's taking on Maya is the commentary, all they seemed to want to focus on was how bad Bleda's striking looked, which was weird, because she's a super grappler and she completely out-grappled the accredited jiu-jitsu black belt in Maya in that fight.
That's the thing. When you are a specialist in one area, I don't really care if you have weaknesses in other sports. And that's the thing about Bleda. She is so good in that one spot. It's like when we talk about with Aaron Blanchfield, for instance. And I know it's difficult to compare a fighter making their UFC debut, although they are coming off Contender Series, to one of the best prospects in the division and now a rising contender, because that's what Blanchfield is. But you don't really care about some of the weaknesses Blanchfield has in her game, because you realize, okay, once she's able
able to get it to where she excels at, you don't really care about any of those other spots. And for Blade Da, not only is her grappling phenomenal, the first thing that I really thought about with this matchup is, physically, she's going to be so much bigger and stronger than Natalia Silva that I really do think if she is able to get to that one spot, if she's able to get that top position, she's going to be a heavy and difficult fighter to get out of that one strength.
Yeah, and if you do go back, you watch that fight that Blade Da had against Maya on Contender Series, she actually does drop her in the third round. It's a knee to the body that sends her back, but really had good opportunities in the grappling exchanges in that fight. Ends up winning, all three judges scoring it 30-26. And I think that the commentary was a little bit more critical based on the fact that she was a minus 600 favorite. They wanted to see a little bit more out of her, but to me, proved enough. And so you've heard quite a bit about Teresa Bleda. Let's focus on Natalia Silva. When Silva made her UFC debut against Canadian Jasmine Jazz Davizius, I didn't think much of Natalia Silva. And the craziest part about it is she was a plus 200 in that matchup against Jazz Davizius.
Impressive.
She looked like a minus 200 in that fight. Like, she really did. I mean, two of the judges scored at 30-27. One scored at 30-26. And she trains out of the same gym as Paulo Costa. And it's his brother that, if I'm not mistaken, is the head coach at a Team Bahacha. For Silva, holy smokes, like, I knew she had a Taekwondo background, and I knew that she was really accredited there. She had broken her ulna. She was originally due to take on Victoria Leonardo a year prior, so she was out for a little over 2 years from being the Jungle Fights flyweight champ to then fighting Jazz Davizius, but her striking looked nothing like the fighter that we saw against Jazz Davizius.
And she's a very complete striker at this point. Like, I really like the volume that she was able to display in that fight, because that really was her outlying skill and what really did separate her from Jazz Davizius, who you don't really get a good opinion for how good Jasmine is if you just watch her fight against Silva, because of how good Silva will look. And you're 100% right. Going from a plus 200 to just dominating a fight is not something we see all that often, but I really do think that with what Silva was able to show and the improvements that she has to be able to make throughout her career, because that's the thing, Silva had a bad record at one point in her MMA career, but the streak that she has been able to go on as of late has been impressive, and has been able to show that. I'll say the same thing about Blade Da, but it's something we say a lot about younger fighters. When fighters are 20-25, they make these massive improvements every single time we see out there. For Blade Da, she still has that potential to make those improvements every time we see her, but what I will say about Silva is, she hasn't been stagnant throughout her progress. I think we have seen an improved fighter every time out there, and that's a great thing to see, because there's fighters that we see get into the top 15 and get to borderline title shots who do not fix holes in their game, who just stay the same form as what they are. They get better at what they're already strong at, and their weaknesses remain their weaknesses. For Silva, I do like the volume that she's been able to display, and I do think that if she is able to keep this fight to the feet, which is a big ask, because again, I think this is a massive talking point in this fight, is the physicality of Blade Da. I think she will struggle on the feet, because you're right, I know they brought it up a lot on Contender Series, Blade Da has good power, but I do think that does come a lot from her physicality, and because she is willing to throw a lot behind her shots. Think about a guy like Damian Maia. Damian Maia is not a good striker, but Damian Maia was willing to throw a lot of power behind his strikes because he was never worried about getting taken down. For Blade Da, I don't really think she's worried about the counter wrestling or the counter grappling from a lot of her opponents, so I do think that at a certain point in her career, we will see that evolution of her just having more confidence in her own strike.
For Blade Da, it's a lot of 1-2, power on the two, it's a lot of leg kicks, and then, of course, power grappling. She goes across the cage, she'll really reach for those double legs. For Silva, she out-grappled the Canadian champion wrestler in Jazz Davizius her last time out. The other thing is, she has great lateral movement side to side. She's really speedy. She can get those counter hooks in there and then just zip right out of trouble, just like Adesanya did from rounds 1-4. Don't count round 5.
I still can't get over that fight, Craig. I'm not going to lie.
Don't sweat the technique, but when you do look at it, she nearly finished the fight 50 seconds in with a flurry of hooks to Jazz Davizius. But my biggest thing is, for Natalia Silva, she has 13 wins. She has quite a few by submission. 6 of her finishes by submission are by armbar, so she is a specialist in that regard. We'll see if Blade is going to be able to figure that out once it does get to the mat, if it does get to the mat. We have a look at the odds in this matchup. Silva open a plus 100. She's a minus 185 favorite right now. Blade open minus 120, plus 150 on the comeback. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprise to us as they are to you. So Silva opened an underdog. She's a favorite right now. I'm going to say fans probably going with Silva, but ever so slightly. I'm going to say over under 60% Silva.
I'll say under.
I'm going to say under, and it's over. So 484 votes, small sample size, start of the week. 64% with Silva, 81% by decision. For the 36% that I played off, 86% by decision. Natalia Silva, again, went from a plus 200 underdog, being a crafty striker on the outside, but with very low volume, needing to utilize takedowns, get submissions. Talking like a world championship striker overnight against somebody who had a UFC win in Jazz Divizi's win over Kay Hansen. Regardless of that, Silva did look so much improved in that 2 years, 2.5 years that she had been away from 2019 to 2022. For me, I really like the physicality and the takedowns out of the younger Bleda in the matchup. So I'm going with the underdog in Bleda here. But again, Silva, I threw it out there in the tweet after the fight was done. Not only did I look like a goofball and not taking Silva, but who would have known that she was going to look that good? But B, I said she looked like a future contender. I think both of these women are going to be ranked at some point in this division. It's just for me, again, those takedowns, hot and heavy from Bleda, and I do think she's going to be able to get the win.
I think this fight is very, it's very black and white if you really want to look at it in a non-objective way. Like, Bleda's going to win 99% of the grappling exchanges, and I think Silva's going to win 90% of the striking exchanges. The difference is, I think Bleda's pressure, along with her clinch, is going to be able to at least get her close enough to not absorb a lot of those shots from Silva at range. I think that's going to be key for Bleda. If she can keep those volume numbers low for Silva and be dominant enough with her grappling, I think that will erase the striking efficiency of Silva out of the mind of the judges, and I do like Bleda's effectiveness with her grappling on the mat. I don't think she's going to sit in full guard, lay and pray. She does do effective grappling. She has good ground and pound, will threaten with submissions, and I do like her for those aspects. And what the thing about Silva is, I almost worry that she's almost too good at grappling for her own good in this matchup for this reason. I worry that she's going to play off her back a little bit and go for submissions, and that might waste a lot of time, because I don't know if either lady's going to be able to get a stoppage in this fight, so it's probably going to go to a decision.
96-31 significant strikes in favor of Silva and her matchup with Jazz Divizi's, but in this one, both of us going with Chechia's own Teresa Bleda to get the win. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have. Main event of this card, Derek Lewis taking on Sergey Spivak. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's
get into it. UFC debut losses in the rearview mirror. A couple of bantamweights looking to make their mark and move forward up through the ranks. We have Fortis MMA's Fernie Garcia taking on Sick Jitsu's Brady Heaston. The nickname's Bam Bam. There's too many Bam Bams in MMA. Find a different nickname for yourself. But what I can say, though, about the now 23-year-old Brady Heaston is, what an impressive fighter. I mean, really, like, if you do look at it and you consider the run that he went on coming into the Ultimate Fighter season 29, it's got to be awkward because Ricky Tercios is also in this card, and they're both on the undercard. But if you look at it for Brady Heaston, he fought a paltry level of competition as a pro. I mean, starting off in 2018, taking on a guy who's 0-2, then a pro debut, 0-4, 0-6, Chad Anheliger, who knocks him out, and then Shane Sargent, who was 0-12, first round, rear naked choke in 31 seconds. Then he stands, ends up on the Ultimate Fighter season 29. It's one of those ones where, okay, you're going to have Juliana Pena's support. You're going to have, you know, the Michael Chiesas of the world that are going to flare and flash their support. So he stands, goes in and fights Josh Reddinghaus. And to me, Reddinghaus holds a lot of water. Go look at his fights that he had against Sergey Morozov over at M1 Global if you need any proof there. Reddinghaus is a pro of over 20 fights. If I'm not mistaken, he's got closer to 30 than he has to 20.
Very experienced for the show.
Reddinghaus is really good. Yeah, a guy that you wouldn't think would need the Ultimate Fighter, and he stand wins that fight by decision. Then he goes in and takes on Vince Murdoch, who was a known commodity, Contender Series, Ultimate Fighter, and also he's supposed to be in the UFC. He stand finished him in the first round. So those really do hold a lot of water. He has a fight of the night style fight against Ricky Tercios. Loses by split decision in that one for the finale of the show. And you can make an argument either way. But regardless, for he stand, you would have thought, okay, well, he lost on the finale of the Ultimate Fighter. He doesn't have a lot of pro experience. He's still a young guy. They're going to want him to get some more, you know, experience on the regional scene. No dice. He takes about a year off, a little over a year off, and now he gets a fight against Fernie Garcia, a guy who's fought at a high level with LFA, looked amazing against, Weems over on Dana White's Contender Series, gets the win there, and then for Garcia, makes his UFC debut. He's a favorite to beat Jurnee Newsome, and in that fight, he just really couldn't get out of first gear. So a good starting point again for both these guys this weekend.
The weird thing that I have with Brady Heaston is we've seen a lot of fighters of his archetype in this weight division in recent memory, to be completely honest. Think about guys like Jimmy Rivera. Ricky Simone right now is a guy who's having a lot of success.
Similar part of the world.
Exactly. Brian Kelleher to a lesser degree, but you get the idea. You have these basic boxers who are good wrestlers who might not be overly dominant with their whole submission game, but they're still control-oriented enough to where they're really going to make you think, and they're really going to threaten you enough with their wrestling to then help them open up their own stand-up. That's the thing about High Stand. He doesn't have the most dynamic stand-up. It's not going to wow you like a Yair Rodriguez, but it is very bread and butter.
The guy throws hammers when he's on the feet.
That's the one good thing about him. It is basic, but he does put a lot behind his shots. Now, Ricky Turner shows when he was having success in that fight and how he was able to have a lot of his own success in the feet was be the longer, rangier guy, be more dynamic on the feet. And I think that's always going to be the thing for High Stand. If you're a guy who throws, think about Dan Hooker throwing the teep kicks against Claudio Poyas. If you're a guy like that who can create that range, be that long distance dynamic striker, I just think fighters like Brady High Stand and all those fighters who are in that kind of category are going to have trouble with that type of fighter. And that's sort of what he finds himself in there with fighting a guy like Fernie Garcia.
Not a fucking chance. No. Fernie Garcia doesn't throw kicks at all.
No, but I still think Fernie is going to be better at range. He's more dynamic from that side. And for High Stand, I just don't know if he's ever going to be able to make up that distance. Now, I called myself out for it in the first fight in the card. Fighters who are his age make up that distance in a very quick time. Every single time out there, we will see them be very impressive. But I was kind of saying jokingly before we started filming, like, in an age where Ultimate Fighter winners don't seem to have the highest ceiling, like, let's be honest, there has been an Ultimate Fighter winner for a while now who's really gone on and made their mark to win a title and whatnot. Like, it's been a while since the show has been top tier relevant. It is kind of surprising that High Stand's still in the UFC. I was kind of seeing them as maybe not giving him the developmental deal, but you get the idea. Go back to the regional scene. We'll keep an eye on you. You look impressive because I think he does have a good foundational skill set, but I do think it needs a lot more polish to really get the most out of it.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at it, a varied wrestling attack from Brady, and if you consider it, he's the type of guy that will go for an ankle pick to turn it into a single leg to then dump you on your back. He'll go for double legs across the cage. He really does have a wide array of takedowns. He's not just focused on, okay, I need a high crotch. Okay, I need, you know, a body lock palm to palm. Like, he really does have it all together, and he can really dominate that area of a lot of different fights that he finds himself
This
in.
Is a very difficult question to answer, but in my mind, there's almost like two camps that High Stand could take. It's, do I refine my submission game more to make my wrestling that much more lethal on the mat, or does he try to evolve his striking more to then open up the wrestling game? Because at this stage of his career, both options are possible, and I do think that, again, he's only 23 years old in a division where he could stay around in for a long time. I just don't think this fight against Fernie Garcia is the best of ideas. I think it's a fighter as promise, but I think with some prospects you can rush them a little bit too quick, and then we never really see them develop to the fullest capacity. Think about a guy like Chase Hooper. Like, Chase Hooper's a guy who had a lot of promise, kind of got rushed, if we're being honest, and now we don't know if we're ever going to see him realize that potential.
So for High Stand, the only two losses on his official record are, of course, the Ricky Turcios loss by split, and he lost by third round finish to Chad Ann Heliger, who ended up in the UFC as well. So for Fernie Garcia, another interesting look. I mean, he was 6-4 as an amateur, 10-1 pre-UFC. He was supposed to take on a different opponent than Weems over on Dana White's Contender Series. Weems misses weight, weighs in 139, knocks him out, and it's a tidy hook and tight that ends up getting the finish. So he goes in and takes on Jurny Newsom, a guy who's somewhat similar to Brady High Stand.
Compact.
I mean, throws hammers, compact, good grappler, Pacific Northwest, and in that fight, again, Garcia couldn't get out of first gear, and he's a guy that is such a proficient and technical boxer coming out of Fortis MMA. Garcia doesn't throw kicks, and when I say that and I gave you a hard time...
No, you're right. I just meant he was more dynamic.
Yeah, he doesn't throw body kicks. He doesn't throw head kicks, and sure enough, he doesn't throw leg kicks either. So it really is a weird one, and it is very much one of those fights where it is a clash of styles, because for Bam Bam, he has that wrestling grappling pedigree. He takes you down. He can threaten with submission, trains with his brother at Alpha Jiu-Jitsu, brother a name of Bryson, if I could say it like Dr. Steve Brule. But when I look at Fernie Garcia, I had to make a comp. People have been really rallying around this. When I watch his fights, kind of reminds me of the last track of 1985's Rush's Power Windows. And if you know this album and you know me, I absolutely love it. It's a great one. It's a lesser-known Rush album. It's not, you know, 2112, but the song is Mystic Rhythms, and it goes a little bit like this. The more we think we know about, the greater the unknown. We suspend our disbelief, and we are not alone. I don't know what to think of this guy. I thought Fernie Garcia had a clear path to move right up through the bantamweight division. I thought, okay, you take on Jurny Newsom. If you're able to crash distance and get rid of his head kicks, you're going to be able to get the win. Garcia is a much more proficient boxer than a guy like Newsom. And Garcia, I didn't see that out of him. So now I'm left sitting here wondering, well, Garcia is a decent offensive wrestler. He's decent in threatening some of them. You go back and watch his fight against Batten Gonzalez, and in that fight, he is able to effectively use his grappling in the first round, opens up his boxing round two, round three. I don't see him going for any takedowns in this fight against C-Stan. Likewise, for Brady, I figure, well, you're going to go out there, put the wrestling shoes on from minute 1 to minute 15. If you get a finish in the middle, you're probably happy with it. So, again, clash of styles, great boxer against a fighter who's really adept on the ground. We look at the odds here. Brady Hestan, open minus 135, minus 153. Rather, that's for Fernie Garcia, brother. And if you look at it for Hestan, open plus 105, he is a plus 125 underdog. So the line is going more towards Garcia out of Fortis. Saif Saud, chief among the corner over there. You know he's going to be yelling and screaming his fighter to victory, hopefully. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprise to us as they are to you. With Garcia gaining, Hestan coming off a loss. I'm going to say Garcia over under 65%.
I'll say over.
I'm going to say over. And look at that. 536 total votes, 57% on Sick Jitsu Zone, Bam Bam. 83% by decision for the 43% that have Garcia, 77% by decision. So the odds are going in favor of Garcia. The fans don't have him. Hestan, the opposites attract. And Matt, how do you see this one? Because Hestan's actually the bigger, longer fighter in this matchup.
I'm picking Garcia, but at least let me explain why, just in case anyone wants to disagree, they can understand my thought process behind it. This is the fight that will then convince me Hestan has at least a decent ceiling. Because I have to be honest, I don't even know how good Ricky Tercios is going to be. Like, I was excited about him coming off of the Ultimate Fighter, if I'm being honest. Like, he said all the right things. He has a fun fighting style. Those are the things you get excited for. But as a fighter with a genuine ceiling in the division, I'm not really sure what it is. And for Hestan, you brought it up. It can't be overstated. His wins are over guys who he was fully expected to win on his way up. And the fact that he had a close loss to Ricky Tercios still doesn't really tell us all that much. So for me, I think this fight against Fernie Garcia, if he's able to go out there and really use his wrestling, which I do expect him to do, I agree with you 100% on your breakdown. I think Hestan, if he is going to have success, he's going to have to use his wrestling for wrestling's sake, but also use it to then open up some of his own striking. Because if he goes in there and tries to work his own jab and just wing power shots, that's when he is then going to eat some of those bigger shots on the counter. So I think for Hestan, he could become the fighter that some people think he's going to be, but I will willingly get this prediction wrong to hopefully be right about him.
Yeah, for Bam Bam Hestan, like, if you look at it, Reddinghouse 17-5 as a pro, one on one of Matt's favorite promotions here recently, XMMA. I love that card. And if you look at it, he beat Vince Murdoch, who at the time was 12-4, having just lost to Luis Saldana on Contender Series. So for him, 0-24 was the combined opponent record before The Ultimate Fighter, but I learned a lot out of Hestan on the show. So for me, I'm going with Bam Bam to get the win in the matchup. Matt going with Fernie Garcia. Definitely let us know who you have in this one, because the votes are in one spot, the odds are in the other. Our picks are split. We really want to hear from you in the comments section. Some big fights on this card. Lewis taking on Spivak in the main event. You're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Unranked strawweights looking to move their way up through the ranks. We have Brazil's Spider Girl, Maria Oliveira, who did look a little bit, you know, in a vacuum, like Anderson Silva last time out in her matchup with Gloria DePaula. In this matchup, she is going to have 3 inches of height and 9.5 inches of reach at strawweight against little monster Vanessa Demopoulos, the former LFA champ. And for Demopoulos, it felt like, okay, next month, she's going to be in the UFC. It's going to happen, right? Like, she won the belt over there. She was unsuccessful here and there. She had to fight on Contender Series. She ends up in the UFC. She fights J.J. Aldrich up a weight class and doesn't get the win. But listen, J.J. Aldrich is a tough out for a lot of women in that division. So Demopoulos moves down to 115, which is her division after all. She fights Silvana Gomez-Juarez. And yeah, that fight that Gomez-Juarez just had against Kovalkiewicz left a lot of question marks. But for Demopoulos, she gets dropped early. And then submits Gomez-Juarez. Her last fight out, she takes on Jinyu Frye. She wins that fight. And listen, she was an underdog in the matchup. And you look at it overall, it was an odd fight for her. But regardless, for Demopoulos, a strong strength of schedule. Overall, pro combined opponent record, 33-12-1. So a pretty tidy record right there. Demopoulos really has fought a good level of competition. For Oliveira, the same thing can be said. I mean, she wins against Gloria DePaula last time out. She was a pretty big, you know, underdog in that fight, a plus 215. And getting that win right there, I know she wins in a really, really close call. She won the first round. She won the third round. 7 of 6 that actually threw out their overall scores and MMA decision scored it for DePaula. But Maria Oliveira can say this at this point. I sent somebody outside of the UFC because Gloria DePaola coming up this week's actually fighting in a four-woman tournament with Invicta at Invicta FC 50. So DePaola there, Valeska Machado also in that tournament, somebody that Maria Oliveira also beat on the regional scene. So for Oliveira, some wins outside of the UFC that you know, some losses like the loss on Dana White's Contender Series that set up Marina Rodriguez very well. A tricky one because, you know, you match those two up again right now, I don't think Oliveira is going to win that fight. And then the other fight that Oliveira has is a loss on a record that you really look at is Takana Asakura over with Ryzen. But Asakura is one of their stars. So kind of being brought in to lose, you kind of feel like in that fight. And she really struggled on the ground in that one too.
And I feel like this is one of those fights where the winner, no matter what, gets a major step up in competition. Because with the strawweight division, it is weird. You always think the women's bantamweight division has been around for the longest. You know, Strikeforce just kind of became the women's bantamweight division. Ronda Rousey, the champ, all that jazz. But the strawweight division is probably the deepest at this point and is probably the most competitive. If
flyweight is now.
Oh, flyweight?
Yeah, flyweight's
I think
hot.
Strawweight has so many good fighters. You got people like Lemos Rodriguez. Like, there's some really talented fighters down here. All I'm saying is, strawweight does have a very deep top 15 of a lot of talented fighters. And then there seems to be the other fighters who are outside of the rankings. So we're all just trying to fight and scrap for that spot to kind of become that 15th fighter. Because it's something we joke about. Every rankings has that, like, 15th and 14th fighter who, on any given week, depending on who just won the freshest matchup, they're going to then get that spot. The strawweight division really does feel like there's a big separation between some of the more proven fighters and some of the unproven fighters. And for Demopoulos, like you said, she always has been a fairly well-known unranked strawweight in this division. And if you're on then a three-fight win streak with a good win over Silva, her last time out, Gomez Juarez, who just lost to someone who just fought for the title, like relevant fighters, I really do think Demopoulos is then going to get a bit of a step up. Because at 34 years of age, I think at some point she is going to have to kind of get it going with ranked fighters. But the thing about Demopoulos that I've always liked is her level of aggression. That's never something that's tapered off, no matter what point of her career she's at. It's something that she does with her striking and with her grappling. She is kind of a scramble-based fighter, which sometimes gets her into some poor positions, but when you risk it, you can get that big reward too. And that's the thing about Demopoulos. She will give up poor positions in pursuit of better positions, but she just never stops moving once the fight hits the mat, and that's the really thing that does set her apart.
And if you do look at this one, for Oliveira coming into the UFC, she takes on Tabitha Ricci, plus 220 underdog in the fight, loses on all three judges' scorecards, 30-27. She gave up the takedown. She ended up down below and just really couldn't get back up in some of those positions. But if you do look at it for Demopoulos in the same breath, she has trained a lot with Tabitha Ricci in the past in Southern California, as well as that fight ready. But the thing about Demopoulos is her takedowns aren't at the same level as Ricci. And that really is the struggle. She is so adept at grappling, but she does have a hard time taking the fight down to the mat. And in the same breath as well, when you look at Demopoulos' striking, it's a lot of jab, overhand right, jab, overhand right. And it's not like a full extension overhand like a Chuck Liddell. It's a tight compact, like a pitcher throwing a baseball in tight. So it really is an awkward shot, and I'm not sure if she's going to be able to land that against somebody like Oliveira, who is so fleet of foot and has that reach advantage. And it 9.5-inch reach advantage, if you don't use it, like, what are we doing?
And that's why I do think this fight really does come down to how often can Demopoulos get the takedown, and when can she get the takedown in the round? Because I think she will struggle at range. I think it's quite obvious, like you had said. When you're at a 9-inch reach disadvantage in a fight, like, that's pretty uncommon, especially for this weight class. And if Oliveira is able to keep her on the outset of her distance, Demopoulos doesn't really have a lot of great combinations to then work her way in. Like you had said, it's a lot of single shots. It's a lot of winging those power shots. It just kind of hoping that she can then collapse into range based off those power shots. And against someone like Oliveira, who should be able to use her movement on the outside, I could see a world where Oliveira could win a pretty obvious kind of 30-27, just fighting that Caitlin Chookagian game plan, if you will.
Somebody who beat Vanessa Demopoulos as an amateur, Caitlin Chookagian.
But I could also see a world where Demopoulos is able to go in there, wing that overhand right effectively enough to disguise her takedown attempts with some of her strikes, and to just go out there and put a pace on Maria Oliveira that she's not really used to.
Well, we'll see how it plays out. The odds in this one, Demopoulos open a plus 130, minus 101 right now. Oliveira open a minus 150. Oliveira now a minus 122 favorite. So the odds closing in on par. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprise to us that they are to you. I'm going to say one of these fighters is a fan favorite in North America. So I'm going to say over under 70% Demopoulos.
I think it'll be under.
I think it's going to be under. Look at that. 546 total votes, 71% Demopoulos, 77% by decision. For the 29% that have Oliveira, 88% by decision. I once said on this channel, I didn't think Maria Oliveira would ever win a UFC fight. And we're here right now, and she beat Gloria DePaola. Now, it was controversial, but regardless, in that fight, she had a lot of success at range against somebody who's a Muay Thai artist in Gloria DePaola. So, a big win there for Oliveira. Again, she was a pretty big underdog there. And if you do look at it, comparing the opponent's records in the wins of Maria Oliveira to those of Demopoulos, I already mentioned it for Demopoulos. Out of the wins, 33-12-1. Including Gloria DePaola, who was 6-4 at the time of that fight. For Maria Oliveira, the wins, 14-22. So not the same level of competition. I don't necessarily like the takedown entries of Demopoulos, but I think having that experience of training with somebody like Tabitha Ricci for such a long time, fighting out a fight ready, going to get you ready for a matchup like this. PRVT, so Oliveira is going to have Jessica Andrade to get ready for a fight like this. So you see those comparisons. But the strength of schedule, the 1-2, the entries, I'm going to take Demopoulos. But again, if somebody from the outside, you know, round the outside, if Oliveira gets the win, 9.5-inch reach advantage, I wouldn't necessarily be surprised. So I have Demopoulos here.
I've got Oliveira, but this is one of those fights where I don't think the winner's going to make their way to the top 15 anytime soon, if I'm being completely honest. Now, both fighters could show us something new in this fight that could make me completely reassess my opinion of them. But I do think Demopoulos and Oliveira do have a lot of progress to make in their games if they do want to actually start fighting some of those top-level fighters. Because even think about a fighter like the Karate Hottie, who right now we're looking at Tapology, isn't even in their top 15. Like, she's a pretty complete mixed martial artist. I know she's at the end of her career when you think about it, but she's someone who can strike with volume, she can grapple. She does have all of the areas you look for in just a mixed martial artist. And I don't necessarily think either one of these ladies had that sort of well-roundedness to their game. I know I'm comparing them with someone who is a long-time vet of the division, but still
ranked 11th in the UFC is Waterson Gomez.
So, well, I didn't realize she was that high still, but I do like Oliveira for her physical attributes in this fight. I do think she'll be able to keep it on the outside, but again, I think this is one of those fights where one of us is going to look dumb no matter what. I think one's going to be fairly dominant with their game plan once they are able to enact it. I still really know whose game plan is going to be able to get put into place initially.
Oliveira going from over a plus 200 in her UFC debut and her second time out to being the favorite in the matchup. Matt going with the Spider Girl here in, listen, homage to Anderson Silva. I'm going to go with the little monster, Vanessa Demopoulos, to get the win. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have. Lewis taking on Spivak in the main event. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it.
Stay positive. Enjoy the journey.
Fight Ready's Kevin A. Tividad looking to emerge from the quicksand. That's his nickname. And get his first win since July of 2020. When he took on fight-ready striking coach Kyle Estrada. And if for Kevin Natividad, he really does have a great opportunity against the former Ultimate Fighter winner, Ricky Tercio, season 29's own, had that win over Brady Heistand, who's also on this card. So it's got to be a little bit awkward, the Spider-Man meme. Hey, like, look at that. We split decision win for Ricky Tercios. And if you do look at this fight overall, a bit of a clash of styles. I mean, for Natividad, in the two fights in the UFC, he's been finished in both, and he took on a varied level of competition. I mean, you're taking on a guy like Miles Johns on short notice. You're taking on a guy like Bakary Dana. It's going to be a tough time out there, but he did get finished in both of those fights, and he really has struggled against the counter left hook in a lot of his matchups, and it's a tale of the test of time, if you will, because if you look at it, even his first loss back in 2017 against a fighter who was 36 years old and 3-2, he gets finished in, what, just seconds.
I love that.
By a counter left hook running in, going for an exchange.
Let's start with Natividad. We talk about some fighters now, okay, they only lose in one way. They only struggle with one type of fighter. Montel Jackson was a guy who I brought this up about last week. How, hey, Montel Jackson in the UFC up until this point has only struggled with pressure wrestlers who are really, really good with their pressure wrestling. So that's why I thought he was going to be able to win his fight, because that wasn't the matchup that he was facing. For Natividad, he has struggled with some of those rangier strikers, which is what Tercios can bring to the table. But Tercios is interesting because I feel like I get excited about him in his UFC debut because I don't watch The Ultimate Fighter. It's not something I really care about, nor have I cared about in a long time. But since we were trying to get more into it, I found myself just kind of attaching myself to Ricky Tercios and being interested in his story. He seemed to say all the right things. He had that exciting fighting style. And really, at the end of the day, that's all I care about. Be exciting in the cage. I'm going to like watching you fight. Tercios did check all of those boxes, but
for every guy who is that exciting, there's always a give and a take to it. I had told you there was a comp that I wanted to bring up, but you said Tony Ferguson. I think for Churchill's, the best version, like the Hall of Fame version, yes, it could be a Tony Ferguson, this great offensive fighter who, yes, has some trouble with his defense, his striking, and with his wrestling. I think that's fair to say with Churchill's as well. But Tercios, I think, is going to have a career like Alex Caceres a bit. I could see him just having a good career, winning some fights, losing some fights, being a borderline ranked fighter sometimes, losing some fights that you think he's going to win, and winning some fights that you think he's going to lose. And I know that's a weird comp to bring up, and that could be any fighter in the UFC. But when you look at Tercios, he is good at a lot of individual areas of MMA, and even in some of those kind of niche areas that you only expected of guys once they do reach the rankings. That's really nice to see out of a guy who's only had one fight in the UFC. The problem is, there's so many areas that he has to make up for defensively that I do worry about him when he does fight a pure pressure wrestler, because I don't know how much attack he's going to have off his back. I do worry about him when he fights that pure power puncher, just because I worry about if he's going to get countered, because his strikes are very long, and he doesn't necessarily pull back defensively all that well.
Kevin Natividad, pure power puncher. Kevin Natividad, pure wrestler. It's just when he brings them together in the cage, that's when he has success. You look at that fight against Estrada, it was that shovel hook that really did land, and that's where he was able to get the finish. But Natividad's a wrestler. He's not necessarily known as a striker. You look at it, he had a wild amateur career on the Hawaiian regional scene. He moved things over to Arizona to get good training. And the only loss that he has as an amateur was to Chaden Lealoa, who's really kind of gone on LFA, Bellator, so on and so forth. So for Natividad, a good opportunity to right the wrongs. He's been off for quite some time. That fight against Bakary Dana was almost a year and a half ago. And for Ricky Tercios, had a long layoff after winning the Ultimate Fighter. One love, you know what I'm saying? But if you look at Ricky Tercios, takes all that time off, takes on Ayman Sahabi, he's a minus 220 favorite, and he went 27 of 235 on significant strikes, and it was weird because for Tercios, he can normally strike on the outside, land from those odd angles, he ducks, and then he throws like two right hands and comes back, and he yells all those traditional martial arts noises, and he tries to get guys into the fight. Like, I went back, and I'll talk a little bit more about the Ultimate Fighter fights, because I think that Tercios has fought two guys in the Ultimate Fighter that are a lot like Kevin Natividad, but for Tercios, in those fights, he wills himself into it, and he has a lot of success. In the fight against Ayman Zahabi, as soon as Zahabi started to pressure him and started to land, you kind of see it in Tercios where he back off, create a little bit more separation, and then go back to trying to land some of that volume with not a lot of accuracy behind it or force.
And Ayman Zahabi wasn't really thought of as a world beater at that time either. We do have to remember, like, most...
He had just beaten Draco Rodriguez about a year and a half before that. He had a long layoff.
But a lot of people felt like that was very much a setup fight for Ricky Tercios, so it was a little bit disappointing to see a guy who was so hyped up have a performance like that. But the other thing that has to be said is Tercios probably isn't as young as you probably think he is. He is almost 30 years old. Like, Robert Whittaker won a UFC title and had won the Ultimate Fighter Smashes before he was 27.
Go back at Ricky Tercios, Season 1 Dana White's Contender Series against Boston Salmon. And if you look at it, Tercios' volume numbers are great. If you just look at numbers on a page, you might think, hey, Tercios won that fight. He got his chin checked by Salmon the entire fight, and Salmon ends up winning the decision.
I just think for Tercios, it's one of those cases of if you are going to put it all together and kind of become that top-tier version of that offensive dynamo that you potentially could become, we are going to have to see that sooner rather than later. Again, I brought this up umpteen thousand times against Howny Barcelos. It was, hey, it's great that now you're starting to put it all together, but you're in your mid-30s. It would have been great if you started putting it all together when you were 27, 28, because then we would have seen you in your prime for a lot longer. For Tercios, you kind of forget, again, he's almost 30, which again, at bantamweight, it's not like he's ancient by any means, but for a guy who is just getting started in the division, you would like for him to have a few more years at his disposal.
Well, for me, my point here with Ricky Tercios on the Ultimate Fighter, taking on Dan Argueta, who we've seen in the UFC, he's the translator or the just the speaker in general for Cub Swanson. And for Tercios, the second fight against Ludovic Chalignon, the first fight that he had against Argueta was one of those two rounders. And if it's tied, they have a sudden death fight. Well, Dan Argueta won the first round, utilizes wrestling. Ricky Tercios wins the second round. And in the third round, Tercios really was, he was able to get the takedown early. He's able to get the back of Argueta. He looked really good in that part. But if you look at it in the second round for Tercios, he really did strike like a crash test dummy. He had a lot more pressure than he did in the first round, but he gets hit a lot by Argueta. Argueta's not really much of a striker. Argueta's a wrestler. He's very similar to a guy like Kevin Natividad. Then the fight against Ludovic Chalignon, First round, second round, it's a lot of Tercios on the outside. That was a three-round fight, so I should say that. I had Tercios winning the first two rounds. A lot of movement, kicks, and then again, odd-angle punches. Shilinyan did get a couple of takedowns in the second round, but he didn't do much with them. Third round, last 20 seconds, go back and watch that. It's absolutely bonkers. It's a brawl, and they both have success there, but it was Tercios winning out. Then the fight against Brady Haystand, where, again, split decision win. You think that Tercios won a couple of the rounds, and he did utilize...
Look better on the feet.
Yeah, he did look a lot better on the feet. He rocked Haystand. He dropped him at one point in that fight as well. So for Tercios coming into this one, it is tricky. Last time out, loses a minus 225 favorite. In this fight, he opened minus 185. He's at minus 153. For Natividad, open plus 160, plus 125. Trying to have a y'all must have forgot type of fight for Natividad. Looking for his first win in over 2 years. We have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise to us there, to you. I'm going to say the fans are probably going to go with the Ultimate Fighter winner. I'm going to say over under 70% Tercios.
I think they'll be over.
And they are over by quite a bit. 561 total votes, 83% Tercios, 84% by decision. For the 17% that have Natividad, 71% by decision. Tercios doesn't have good takedown defense, and if Kevin Natividad puts the wrestling shoes on, he could really win this fight. Like, really win this fight.
Remember when our boy, and I'm just going to call him Nikolai, fought Carlos Alberg, and we said the exact same thing? The way I look at this fight
you
is...
You don't have to shout.
If Ricky Tercios puts it all together, he's going to look phenomenal in this fight, win like a 30-27, look really good with his volume, defend a lot of takedowns, and really at least regain people's confidence that they once had with him winning the Ultimate Fighter and where he could become as a fighter. If Kevin Natividad puts it all together, I'm still going to be worried about him eating a big shot at most points throughout this fight. I guess I'm picking Ricky Tercios, but I'm trying to throw up a couple red flags. I didn't love the performance he had coming off the Ultimate Fighter win. I love the gritty performance he was able to have against Brady Haystand, because that was a fight where he faced adversity, got taken down, had to dig really deep and look good in that last round to really be able to pull it out. So I'm going to pick Ricky Tercios, but I do think we are going to need to see more out of him in this fight for me to really think, okay, this guy can go on to become a ranked fighter in the future.
It really is a pop and popcorn type of fight that's out there for you. So, I mean, it really is a tough one. Like, for Tercios to be warranted as a favorite like this, it's due to the fact that Natividad hasn't won in quite some time. And for Natividad, some of the recent wins have been due to his hands. But really, when it comes down to it, you need to see the wrestling. I haven't seen the wrestling in some time. For that reason, I like Tercios. And Tercios, even when he gets taken down, threatens with submissions. He's very active with his guard in terms of strikes. Now, how much does that really play with the judges? That always remains to be seen. But for both of us, we're going to go with Ricky Tercios, Hadouken, to get the win. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. Some big fights on this card, including Iwan Kutsalaba and Kennedy and Zechiku, and Derek Lewis taking on Sergey Spivak in the main event. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
On November 4th, it was announced that Jose Johnson, Matt's favorite fighter, was out of his fight against Vince Morales. So in on short notice, steps up Chapel, Miles Johns. You have a great fight between Fortis MMA and Syndicate and Vince Morales. It's really hard to get a read on this guy. We got to say that straight up. You look at his overall UFC run. I mean, if you even consider Dana White's Contender Series and the UFC, you want to make that stretch. He's 3-5, and he reminds me of a lot of a guy that we talked about last weekend. Mike Trezano was taking on Sungwoo Choi. Sungwoo Choi had a couple of really good performances, and everybody thought, hey, we're off to the races. Vince Morales, just three fights ago, he gets a win over Draco Rodriguez. He looked great in that fight. He then takes on Luis Smolka. He knocks him out, and he knocked him out like cold. He looked really good. And then he took on Jonathan Martinez, and he loses. Now, I don't think all hope is lost with Vince Morales, because he was a pretty big underdog against Martinez. I think the only thing that might have surprised people was that he went for and executed on a couple of takedowns, though they didn't really do a whole lot. But for Vince Morales, this is a guy that really has based himself around having sound wrestling. He was a great wrestler in high school, wrestled a little bit in college before he had to drop out. Same thing can be said for Miles Johns. So for Morales, he's coming out of Oregon. For Miles Johns, Kansas State High School wrestling champ, wrestled, and he was team captain in college as well. I think it was injuries that forced him out. Both guys have similar bases for their skills with their wrestling. So I wouldn't say they cancel each other out, because I do myself think that one guy's a little bit better at wrestling than the other. But when it comes to the striking, Vince Morales is a much longer, rangier striker, whereas Miles Johns goes in and out on a straight line, doesn't really cut much for angles, and tries to throw everything in his right hand.
But that's what makes this fight so much fun. Like, if these guys do end up putting on the wrestling shoes for 50 minutes, I'm going to be genuinely interested in who does get the better of those exchanges. Because although I do think Johns is the more physically strong of these two, and I do think that is going to matter if they do start to get into those wrestling exchanges, especially early on into the fight, I'll be very curious to see who can keep that going, especially in the third round. Because if neither guy is able to land with some of their power shots early on, let's say Morales isn't able to get his combinations going, because that's the one thing about Morales that I think he can have a lot of confidence in himself. I like his output more, but the thing is, does he have confidence in his own output? Because if Miles Johns can really make him pay when he does open up with his own hands, I think Miles Johns could go out there and put on a performance where he throws less significant strikes, but he still gets the decision. I know we don't often see that, but not every significant strike is created equal. And for Miles Johns, I do believe he is the more heavy-handed of these two fighters, but that's why I'm so excited for this fight. I don't think either guy has bulletproof defense by any means whatsoever. Like, if Miles Johns then goes on to fight some of the upper echelon bantamweights, Piotr Jan's a bad example, but let's use Piotr Jan as an example. Like, these guys might be able to hit him with a couple shots offensively, but you're definitely going to worry about the shots coming back their way as well. What I do like out of Morales, though, what I will be very interested to see is, if he does go for takedowns early and uses his clinch early, will he be able to use the clinch effectively? Because I think if he is able to judge that distance to, okay, Miles Johns is having success in boxing range, I'm just going to go for the clinch, try to wear on him a little bit, use my body to just try to get rid of some of the explosiveness from Johns. Because I see this as a fight where Johns could have success early, but I do think every minute that ticks off the clock might start to favor Vince Morales.
Well, and I don't think that's much of a hot take. You go back to Miles Johns' UFC debut against Cole Smith, Canadian, and in that fight, Johns looked good in the first round. The second round was a bit of a wash. Johns won at the third round. Miles Johns did not look very good, and Cole Smith was, you know, getting on his back. He was really winning out, and obviously Johns ends up winning. But the craziest part for Johns is, I think a lot of people projected him to have a top 15 ceiling, and in all of his UFC fights, I'm going to just mention what the odds were in all of these fights. He fights Smith, he's a minus 145 favorite, wins that fight. Fights Mario Bautista, loses by finish, he's a minus 150 favorite in that fight. Fights Kevin Atividad, finishes him, minus 135, gets a bonus. He takes on Anderson Dos Santos, he's a minus 225 favorite, finishes him, gets a bonus. He takes on John Castaneda, minus 170 favorite. He loses in the third round of that fight. It's a knock-em-out, drag-em-out type of fight. So for Johns, that fight that he had against Castaneda was 9-10 months ago. And if you look at it for Johns, he's taking this one on short notice. Morales is getting ready for the striker, and Jose Johnson, who's had as many amateur fights as I think anybody would feel comfortable in having, and just about as many as pro fights. But if you look at it for Morales in the UFC, yeah, I mean, it has been a little awkward. And you look at the losses, he loses to Domingo Pilarte on Contender Series, he gets finished. He loses to Benito Lopez, but he won that fight. He loses to Chris Gutierrez and Jonathan Martinez.
Jonathan Martinez is pretty good.
Yeah, his wins, Ayman Zahabi, it was a tight fight, but it was in Ottawa, which is close to Montreal, so that's a good one. He beat Draco Rodriguez, and then if you look at it, he has that win over Smolka. So the camp change is always fun because he's looked great since he's moved down to Syndicate. He's looked amazing with John Wooden crew since he's moved from the Pacific Northwest. But again, when you do look at this one, Vince Morales can mix it up with the grappling, threat of the takedown, opens up his striking. He's got better volume than Miles Johns. Miles Johns is not flat-footed, but plants on his feet and throws a lot of his shots. And it really is a tricky one where Morales is the guy that cuts angles side to side and has better volume. Miles Johns moves in and out. And that was what caused Johns so many issues when he's taking on John Castaneda. Castaneda is a better leg kicker, and he's also a southpaw. Morales is not. But that's what makes this fight so tight.
It does. I like the power of Miles Johns, though, and I definitely like it early, and this is why. Vince Morales is going to play the game of Miles Johns. That's why I like this fight so much and why I'm so excited for this fight. Both guys could win any single way that you can imagine, like submission round 1-3, knockout round 1-3, decision either way, just because they are so talented and their skill sets do complement each other so well. I will be very curious to see who goes for the first takedown, though, and who has more confidence in their own wrestling, because I can honestly say that I can see a world where either guy does have success with their own offensive wrestling, especially if Johns does get tired as the fight goes on. It could be a fight where Johns gets a takedown round 1, gets some takedowns denied in round 2, and by the time round 3 rolls around, Morales is the
someone who's really pressing forward and having success with his own. I just think Morales is going to walk into a lot of power shots in this fight, though. I do think that movement is almost going to be to a detriment at a certain point, to where he might walk into some of those big power shots of Miles Johnson. If that's the case, I like Johnson's power a little bit in this fight. If Vince Morales is meeting him halfway, I think that's definitely going to be trouble.
The thing that weirds me out, one of the last pictures that Miles Johnson threw out there, this couple shots of him kind of boxing, moving around with his coach there at Fortis, and then he's got Devils in the Details. Is it cryptic because he has knee pads on? Is that because he's going to wrestle a little bit? I don't know if it is, but that's just something to keep in mind. You have a look at the odds in this one. John's open a minus 160, minus 140. Vince Morales open a plus 140, plus 115. We have a look at the Tapology votes. They're a surprise to us. They are to you. One guy's a fan favorite and one guy's not. So I'm going to say over under 72.5% Miles Johns.
I think they'll be under. I think they'll be close to 50. Nope.
Way over. 361 total votes. 84% Johns. 76% by decision for the 16% that have Morales. 59% by decision. In Miles Johns' last fight, where he was a minus 170 favorite against Castaneda, 89% of 3,436 voters had Johns to beat Castaneda, and Johns lost that fight. So very similar circumstances in terms of where the odds open, where the fan vote is. I like Miles Johns in the matchup with the wrestling, with the power shots, with the forward movement. I don't like the fact that he never cuts angles or traditionally doesn't cut angles. He moves in on the center line. Great opportunities for Morales here. I have a lot of underdogs in this card, if you haven't realized it already. Morales isn't one of them, but it's pretty darn juicy here.
I also like Miles Johns in this matchup. Like I said for the Tapology votes, though, I look at this as a very close 50-50 fight, just because both guys do excel in a lot of the same areas of MMA. But I agree with you. I like the power out of Miles Johns. I think that's really going to be the thing that helps him.
Both of us going with Chapo Miles Johns to get the win. Let us know who you have in the matchup down below in the comments section. Some big fights left on this card. Jack Della Maddalena is taking on Danny Roberts. That should be a good one. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. Former Invicta FC flyweight champion Jennifer Maia was a plus 1,000 underdog in her title bid against Valentina Shevchenko back in 2020. And hey, we remember that fight. She won round two. But lost 49-46 on all three judges' scorecards. And for Maia, since she lost that fight, it's been quite a bit of a mixed bag. Beating Jessica Ai, another former title challenger, losing to Caitlin Chookagian, a former title challenger, and then her last time out losing to Manon Fiorot, who will soon be a title challenger, we all assume. And for Maia, she's one of three ranked fighters on this entire card, but the lone competing on the prelim portion. If you couldn't have guessed it already, you have Derek Lewis and Sergey Spivak in the main event as the other two. So for Maia, she goes from title to former title challenger, future title challenger, to completely out of the rankings and taking on Ukraine's Marina Moroz. And for the Iron Lady, she's a team, what is she, a coach on the Women's Olympic Boxing team in Ukraine. Boxing really is her bread and butter. She's a master of sport in the discipline. And for Marina Moroz, she doesn't necessarily fight like a boxer in every single one of her fights, and you can go back to her fight against Joanne Wood when she was at strawweight. You could go to Jennifer Maia's fight against Joanne Wood as a flyweight. Both these women have first-round armbar finishes over Wood, so I'm sure Wood's probably going to like go grab a snack or go to the local 7-Eleven when this one takes place. But for Moroz, three-fight win streak dating back to 2019. You consider the third-to-last fight, Sabina Mazow, then Maeda Buena Silva, then Maria Agapova, her last two times out, big-time bonuses. And for Moroz, she really is gaining a lot of steam in this division.
She definitely is, but this is a huge step up in competition, going from Agapova to someone like Jennifer Maia, who was the first fighter in this weight class to have genuine success against Valentina Shevchenko. And it does feel like every other fighter who has then gone on to fight Valentina has then faced, or at least gone off the similar game plan.
And Jan Jacek had more success at 125.
I mean, a little bit. Jan Jacek lost every round, though. Like, at least Maia got one. My point is, Maia was the first person to win a round and have any success. And she did it with her grappling. And Tyler Santos, the last fighter who had success against Valentina, followed Jennifer Maia's game plan to have that success. Everyone who's followed Ioana's game plan has gotten knocked the F out and has looked very, very bad. So for Maia, I do feel like you have to give her that respect for being the first person to at least make the champion look somewhat vulnerable. But the issue has been, I think about it like, I really like the Raptors, and they would lose to LeBron James in the playoffs every single year. And there's teams like this in every sport where their destiny is almost the second round of the conference finals, because you know what their weaknesses are and you know what their strengths are. And you know that those teams who are then going to go on to the championship level are going to be able to exploit some of their weaknesses weaknesses. And for Maya, I feel like at this point in her career, we just know what she excels at, which is the offensive grappling. But we do know what her weaknesses are on the feet, especially with her at-range striking. And I think against someone like Maryam Burroughs, who is so good with her 1-2s and her volume striking, is really going to give her trouble.
When the hell does Jennifer Maia offensively grapple in the UFC?
Jennifer Maia is someone who, yes, she has good Muay Thai. She throws kicks from the outside. I don't think if she does that against Maryam Burroughs, she's going to have any success.
No, and well, listen, we'll let the cat out of the bag right now at this point in the video. I don't think it's going to be one of the longer ones we've ever made. But for Jennifer Maia, she's an underdog in the matchup. As a ranked fighter against an unranked. Like, she opened a plus 130, she's plus 147. Moreau's open minus 150, minus 180 right now. Jennifer Maia stands square, walks people down like this, throws kicks, limited boxing, doesn't cut the cage, and has a hard time when facing strikers that can throw a lot of volume at her, like she did against Fyodor, like she did against Chookagian. And when Moreau strikes, not that she's to the level of Chookagian or Fyodor, but she strikes in the same type of manner.
They do have a little bit more snap on their shots, for sure. But that's the thing about Moreau's, and this is the thing that people have to realize. She is an amateur boxing coach, which is really impressive. But in amateur boxing, it's not about knockouts. You're not going in there to knock your opponent out. It is more about the technique and going from point A to point B and just getting those touches in. And you do see that reflected in Maria Moreau's style. She's not a fighter who's going to go in there and really sit down on a lot of her shots. She is very volume over power. And it does get frustrating, if I'm being honest. Like, when you watch her fights, it's always very difficult to judge a Marina Moreau's fight because you don't really know what landed and what didn't land. You realize she is very active, and when she uses the grappling side of her game, which I'm sure we'll talk about, you definitely see how effective she can be. But when it is on the feet, I always find it very difficult to tell what round she is and is not able to win, because the majority of the time, Marina Moreau's will have the higher volume at the end of the round. If you just look at the pure numbers, Marina Moreau's is running laps around these ladies in every single round. But then when you take into consideration effective striking, you do notice that she does get landed on more than she will land on her opponent sometimes. It's just the fact that there is so much volume associated with what she throws on the feet, it does become misleading. But my whole point about Maya in her grappling was, I don't think her basic boxing combinations and her kicking is going to be enough. I think if she does go in there and try to use the game plan that we have seen as of late, we're just going to see one of those rinse and repeat Maria Moreau's on the outside, I'm going to win 30-27. I really think Jennifer Maya needs to mix in the grappling, because if we don't see that version of her at all, Maria Moreau's just going to be happy to stand on the back foot and throw her crazy amount of volume.
Yeah, Maya's takedowns aren't the greatest either, and the trouble for Maya is they threw her right to the fire after she was the Invicta champ. Her first fights against Liz Carmouche, who challenged for the belt at 125 and 135, and then was successful in capturing the belt over the Bellator. But for Maya, she's got the jiu-jitsu pedigree, Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt. She trains at a shoot-the-box monstro. She just got married. Her husband's the coach. And for Maya, yeah, the takedowns are the trouble. It's kind of like Vanessa Demopoulos, who's earlier on in this card. Great at grappling, but not great at getting the fight down to the mat. Maya's a little bit more proficient when it does come to her boxing. She is quite adept at Muay Thai, but she doesn't have the same level of volume and zip as somebody like a Marina Moreau from the outside. So again, the odds favor Moreau in this matchup. Maya is the underdog. We have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise to us, they are to you. I'm going to give Maya a shadow of a doubt here. I'm going to say over under 60% Maya.
It should be over, you would think, because she definitely has the higher level of competition.
It's not. 564 total votes, 74% Moreau's, 87% by decision for the 26% that have Maya, 85% by decision. Matt, Marina Moreau's, if you go over to her Instagram, I was trying to figure out, like, she is training an American Top Team, a lot of great people to train with at that gym. 100%. She's really looked good in these last three fights as well, because you look at the two losses before that, and they are years ago. Carla Sparza and Angela Hill. Hill took her down in that fight and landed some really good volume in that one. But Moreau's really proud of being Playboy centerfold recently. Matt, I'm 99% sure Playboy doesn't make magazines anymore, so I have no idea what being a Playboy centerfold is in 2022. I don't know if you're just modeling clothes for them. I don't know what it means.
No idea.
It's not like the Jay Giles Band song. But in this matchup, Matt, do you think that the volume numbers on the outside can win it for the Iron Lady?
It's a weird fight because as of late, Maria Moreau's had a lot more success with her grappling. But again, I've said that. I don't think she can grapple with Jennifer Maya. I think that is Maya's best path to victory. And if Moreau's does go in there with that volume striker mentality, I think she can have a really effective fight. But again, I'm saying this right now. I'm going to pick Marina Moreau's, but a lot of this pick is just based off of her with the crazy amount of volume. A lot of those strikes aren't going to land. And I realize that everybody who put money on Jennifer Maya or who picked Jennifer Maya at the end is going to be very upset about about the decision. But when you do look at how Maria Moreau's fight, she does do a great job against low-volume fighters. That is the one thing that her skill set can really take advantage of. Or Joanne, formerly known as Calderwood, jumping into full guards. But I do think Moreau's, in her one niche in her style, is going to offer a difficult challenge to Jennifer Maia. But again, I've said this, huge step up in competition for Marina in this
one. Too big of a step up. I do like that Moreau's fight of the night that she had against Maeda Buena Silva. She was really able to mix it up. It was a close fight, but a great one for Moreau's. And in taking on somebody like Jennifer Maia, I think Maia hits a little bit harder than the fighters that Moreau's taken on. She's definitely much more adept than somebody like Maria Agapova, who,
oh, yeah,
offensively, Agapova's good. I mean, I've never seen a more disgusting submission than Jillian Robertson when she put her to sleep her last time out. But for me, I do like Maia. Again, it's a large step down a competition if in relative terms for Maia. So I'm going to go with the former title challenger here, and Maya's the underdog. Matt going with the Iron Lady, who's really on the rise, looking for a fourth win in a row in Moreau's to get the win. You let us know down below in the comment section who you have in this matchup. A great fight on this card, headlined by Derek Lewis and Sergey Spivak. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Scrappy flyweights coming up on this weekend's card, headlined by Lewis and Spivak. We have the former Fight Nights Global champ, Zalgas Zhumagulov, taking on Inner G, Charles Johnson, the former LFA flyweight champ. He won the interim belt. He defended the interim belt, and then he was able to win that unified belt. But was it really unified? He beat Carlos Mota, a guy who's also in the UFC at this point. Johnson had a really hard time out in his UFC debut. Took on Mohammad Makhachev, who may very well fight for the title someday. And in that fight, Makhachev landed 12 of 26 takedown attempts. And he was able to really win out in that one aspect. Didn't do any damage, like, at all in that fight. But it was really the wrestling and the constant pressure that was able to get it done. And for Charles Johnson, it's been said by a lot of other people, if I'm not mistaken, we said it too, if every fight was a 5-round fight, Charles Johnson would win 9.5 out of 10 fights. Because Johnson has incredible cardio. He has such a wild base for MMA. Boxing experience. He was an AAU national champion in track and field and a 2-time national champion in steeplechase. He's played multiple different sports. He has a Kay Hansen background in boxing. He was 1-5-4 between 2017 and 2020.
Okay.
And listen, it's good to have that experience, I guess. He's a Golden Gloves guy. But for Charles Johnson, it really is. Nice kicks from the outside, holds his hands relatively low. He will get out-wrestled in certain exchanges, but that opens up his scrambles, and his offensive wrestling is so very good. And that's why in this matchup with Zhumagulov, a guy coming off a split decision loss to Jeff Molina, a fight where if you look on MMA decisions, 12-1, the people that scored it for Zhumagulov. But I know I threw a tweet out there and I went back and found it. I had a 29-28 Molina in the fight, but I also put after that, if it was a 30-27 Zhumagulov, I wouldn't cry robbery. It was a really, really close fight. Zhumagulov was on him like the butter that I had on my blueberry bagel this morning. Like, he was all over him, trying to get the takedown, trying to push forward. But you look at it for Zhumagulov, 1-4 in the UFC, and he's still around. He must be doing something right. And every fight that he's had, I can talk about a point where Zhumagulov had success in that one.
I just think Zhumagulov's a perfect example of a great test for any prospect making their way up the division. And he's a good fighter, too, because whether you do win or whether you lose to him, A, it's not going to be so devastating that, oh, you can't get your career back on track if you do lose to him. And if you beat him, he's still probably going to expose one weakness that you had in your game.
He sent Jerome Rivera to the UFC.
Jerome Rivera didn't have a great experience in the UFC, so I wouldn't say that's the best example. But for Zhumagulov, if you are that top-level prospect, you're probably going to look good against him. And that's why I do like Zhumagulov, because he is a well-rounded enough fighter to where, again, whatever your strength is, he can probably match you in some of those areas. And then whatever your weakness is, he's going to try to take advantage of that. But the problem that I've always had with Zhalgas is he's almost too aggressive for his own good, be it with the wrestling or with the striking. He's just a guy who leaves himself wide open. He's a guy who, when he goes for wrestling attacks, when he goes for his own takedowns, he'll leave his neck out there. You can threaten with a submission, try to go for a transition off that and really threaten and be dominant with some of those positions. But that also shows up in his striking too. He's someone who can lunge when he is aggressive. But what I like about this fight is I hope it does go late, because I agree with you. Charles Johnson is a guy who does get stronger as the fight goes on, can fight at the same pace for the whole entire fight. What Zhumagulov does well to a lot of these prospects is he will maintain a fairly straightforward pace for the majority of the fight and threaten you with volume striking, power striking, and wrestling. So I think as this fight goes late, we're going to learn a lot more about Charles Johnson, because you're right. In the Makhachev fight, A, Makhachev might be a future title challenger. He really does have that kind of a ceiling. And B, he laid on top of Charles Johnson for the majority of that fight. Like, there wasn't a lot that you could really take from it from Charles Johnson's camp. So I think this is a great reset for him against a guy who, you're right, he's probably one of the most well-known 1-4 fighters in the UFC. Because for Zhumagulov, again, do you think he's ever going to go in there and beat guys in the top 10? Maybe not. But I don't think he's an easy fight for any of those guys,
and
honestly.
Flyweight's absolutely stacked with talent. At this point, there's more people outside of the rankings than there are ranked fighters. And a few years ago, there was like 3 guys outside of the rankings and then the top 15. But for Zhumagulov, you go and you look through it. Let's focus on the last 3 fights. He was a minus 315 favorite against Jerome Rivera. Well, he won that fight quite easily. He then goes in there. He's a plus 240 underdog against Kopp. He gets knocked out. He was a plus 155 underdog against Jeff Molina. And then before that, like his fight against Haliem Paiva, most people thought that he won that fight. And then his next fight, he took on Amir Albazi, won the first round. Round 2, round 3, it was the waves of Albazi.
Talented fighters, dude.
And for Johnson, as a champ over with LFA, wins a split decision over Yuma Horiuchi, who I thought won the fight. And Yuma lost a point early in that one for a nut shot. He beats Joao Camilo. He ends up finishing him in that one. And in the fight against Carlos Mota, Mota looked pretty good early on with a lot of those long-range striking attacks, sending Johnson back. But as the fight went on, round 3, round 4, and then when Johnson ended up getting the finish, he really did look good as that one went on. So we look at the odds in this one. Johnson opened a minus 175, minus 165 right now. Zhumagulov opened plus 150, plus 135. We have a look at the Topology votes. Surprise test there to you. Zhumagulov's 1-4 in the UFC, and that's bad.
It is.
But he's better than a 1-4 fighter in the UFC, if that makes any sense. I'm going to say Johnson over under 65%.
I think it'll be under.
I think it's going to be
under.
I've
been bad at these, though.
Way over. 570 total votes, 82% Johnson, 68% by decision, 23% by knockout. If he knocks out Jaga Zhumagulov, it would surprise me. 18% that of Zhumagulov, 78% by decision. I could see this one going to a decision. It's the trouble of Johnson has the boxing experience, but you watch him fight and he's not a boxer at all. He holds his hands really low. He doesn't really throw in combination a lot. His kicks open everything up. He kicks the head, body, and to the legs. Spent some time at Tiger Muay Thai. He was, if I'm not mistaken, a Tiger Muay Thai scholarship recipient, somewhat similar to Mallory Martin, if you want to go that way. But for Johnson, it's a lot of kicks and not a lot of boxing. For Zhumagulov, it's a lot of plant and throw. And he talked about it. His over-aggressiveness can cost him in a lot of matchups. I don't know if this is going to be the one, just because for Zhumagulov, he's at such a height disadvantage and reach disadvantage against a lot of his opponents. In this one, it is pronounced. And the other thing for Johnson is, think of the tallest flyweights you know. Nate Maness was 5'10 a couple weeks ago, lost his fight. Who else? Like, there's not a lot of really tall guys in this division. Johnson's one of them. We'll see if that amounts to anything in the fight. I think you're going to get a lot of wrestling, a lot of scrambles. I'm going to go with the younger guy in Charles Johnson in this one. I think he's got a little bit more once he gets down to the mat than Zhalgas does. But we saw Zhalgas look great against Jeff Molina's last time out and surprised a lot of people.
Exactly. Whether you thought he won or lost that fight, you were definitely impressed by the performance that he was able to put in. And one of, like, Jeff Molina is one of the most hyped up prospects in the division. I know Makhachev, we just talked about, he's another one of those guys, but Jeff Molina's cut from that same cloth for the most part, and he's a guy who a lot of people think will be in that top 5 sooner rather than later. So I think for Zhumagulov, it is unfortunate the position they just find himself to be in, because if he loses to Charles Johnson, you doubt they're going to keep him around, which is unfortunate to say because it's been a memorable run. But I agree with you, I also have Charles Johnson in the fight.
Both of us going with Marcelo's own Charles Johnson to get the win. Let us know if you have Erkan Kusha and American Top Teams Zhalgas Zhumagulov. Some great fights on this card. I don't know. I'm looking forward to Danny Roberts, Jack Della Maddalena. You should tune into that fight. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Jack Della Maddalena is absolutely rolling. And with Rookie of the Year honors in sight, coming off of 2 first-round knockout wins to start off his UFC career, he's going to look to try and cap off a busy 2022 with a win over Hot Chocolate Danny Roberts, which is sometimes easier said than done. Because for Danny Roberts, you look at his overall body of work in the UFC, he's been around for a time or two. 7-5 with the promotion, 2 fight of the nights, 1 over Dominic Steele, where he ends up getting dropped, and then he just rallies, has a great fight in that one, and a fight of the night as well against David Zavada back in 2018. And for Roberts, his last number of fights, his last 5, he is 2-3 in those fights, but you consider it, loses against Hannibal Claudio Silva by submission. If you're going to lose to Claudio Silva, probably by submission. he welcomed in Michelle Pereira to the UFC. Pereira said, thank you very much. I'm going to finish you by flying knee. He beat Salim Imadiyev in a fight where he was just really well-rounded. Looked great in that one almost 3 years ago. Beats Ramazan Ameeb by split decision. He shouldn't have won that fight. He lost the first two rounds. Third round, what happened to Ameeb? He becomes a kickboxer.
He does.
And in that one, Roberts looked good in the third round. And if Dominic Cruz was a judge, I mean, the third round really leaves a good impression in the judge's mind. So that's how fights are judged. And then his last time out, he loses against Francisco Trinaldo. But for Danny Roberts in this matchup, taking on Jack Della Maddalena, he can really pull a lot out of the opponents that he's taken on in the past. Boxing heavy guys, guys that aren't really that tall for the weight class. A guy like Jack Della Maddalena might be a little reminiscent of the body type of a guy like Salim Imadiyev. Or like Mike Perry, a guy he's fought in the past.
You're not wrong at all, but I will be curious to see, because I was someone who thought, okay, Danny Roberts can occupy one of those action fighters in 170 space, where this is the type of fight that eventually you're going to find yourself in.
Like a Nico Price or Randy Brown or Luke
Tim Means, Max Griffin. Like, there's a lot of guys in this division who kind of find themselves in that space right now, but Danny Roberts is kind of one of those fighters. Until he fought Francisco Trinaldo, and I thought the volume of Danny Roberts was really going to impress in that fight. I thought that was going to be the one thing that was going to help him, because Trinaldo does have great power, even though he's had this weird late career resurgence. We all know how shifty he is, and how he can hit those pullback left hands. But the thing about Trinaldo is, he's not a very active fighter. He never has been. When he was 23, he wasn't an active fighter. So now that he's 43, that hasn't changed either. Danny Roberts didn't really get out of second gear in that fight, though, and that's something that, okay, if we saw Danny Roberts from 4 years ago in this fight against Jack Della Maddalena, then okay, he might get into a fight of the night, he might get into a brawl, that might be to his detriment, but at least I think he's going to land a couple of his own shots. I just don't know if that's the Danny Roberts we're going to see, because, and again, I can be wrong, I don't know if he is that fighter anymore. I can see him going out there and having a couple flashes, but I don't know if he's willing to really bite down on the mouthpiece and get into that type of fight with Jack Della Maddalena, because let's be honest, if he does, it's probably not going to be a long night. Della Maddalena might not be the most skilled or technical fighter when you really think about him on like an Alex Pereira level or a Bo Nickel level for prospects, but he's a pretty good mixed martial artist who really has a well-rounded skill set. He's tough when he has to be tough. He's technical when he has to be technical. Like, he is a prospect that you can get excited about, and I think those are the type of prospects who tend to look good against fighters like Danny Roberts. Although, Danny Roberts, when you do kind of count him out, that's when he can go into his pocket, pull out another fight of the night.
Well, if you do look at it for Jack Della, and you consider, I mean, who's he going to struggle with? It's going to be those guys that really pressure, get in his face, and threatened with a lot of the takedowns. You look at his fight against Angelusa, and it was just all over the place. It was a fight of the night. Della ends up getting a contract, but it's one of those ones that, hey, Ange, get another fight out there, we'll bring you in, and that's exactly what they did. So for Della, that's a great win to have in your back pocket, but even the fights that he had on the regional scene, there were guys that would get into the phone booth, withstand some of that power, work the takedowns, that's when his opponents would have success. And you know the story already about Della. He went 0-2 to start his career, losing by finish, told his coach he'd win 10 in a row, end up in the UFC, and gosh darn it, didn't he do it.
Pretty impressive.
But for Della, yeah, I mean, beating Pete Rodriguez on short notice is one thing when you do Wardley Alves, but going out his last time out against Ramzan Ameeb, who, like, half his body was sunburnt, it was a really weird look for Ameeb, but landing the body shot, getting the finish, he really did look good in that matchup, and I was surprised because Ameeb normally turns into a kickboxer as his fights go on, but Ameeb decided to be a kickboxer, and he did get the takedown. And then Della ended up really doing well in the scramble, getting back up to his feet and continuing to do his own thing.
And I was impressed by the way in which he was able to handle Ameeb, because like you had said, Ameeb's a guy who you can win against. Very rarely you look good against him when you do beat him, though. You are going to have to withstand some of that wrestling. Yes, if you do withstand that big storm, if you can defend the grappling, you can look good and have your opportunities to win it late. But the fact that we saw Della Maddalena go to the body, go to the head, withstand some of the adversity with some of the wrestling, that gave me more confidence in him moving forward than if he just went in there and knocked him out with the first punch. Because, again, Ameeb is one of those guys, you can look at his record and kind of scoff at him, but I really do think beating a guy with his skill set is a very impressive thing for a guy to do so young in Maddalena's career.
The former M1 Global middleweight champ, Ramzan Ameeb, both these guys with the success there. One guy's win definitely holds a lot more water than the other, but if you look at Della when he strikes and compare him to Danny Roberts, Danny Roberts is going to throw a much more varied attack to all three levels with his boxing and his kicks. He does throw a lot of head kicks, a lot of body kicks. And for Della, he will switch stances quite a bit, but it really is a boxing heavy attack. He's got nice leg kicks, but when he's working from orthodox, it really is the left hook that he likes to land. Then I'll switch to southpaw, left straight down the middle, and it is one of those things that reminds me a lot of a guy like Dustin Poirier, the right hand dominant southpaw. For Della, it is that left hand all the time, even though he is switching stances quite a bit. So something to look out for in definitely the matchup. And the thing for Danny Roberts too, you mentioned it, and this is kind of one of my points. For Danny Roberts, really low in terms of volume against Trinaldo, who you would have thought on the outside he'd have a lot of success against him, even if Trinaldo's trying to crash the distance himself and pushing a pace. But if you look at it for Roberts over his UFC tenure in 12 fights, 3.13 strikes landed per minute to 3.32 absorbed. UFC average is 3.4. He's below average in both categories, so we'll see what he's able to do here. He's training in England at, Aspire Combat Sports Academy, not in Florida for this camp. He's been out of, at the time, Sanford, now Killcliffe FC. So we'll see how he's able to make out here, getting that training back at home. But when we have a look at the odds in this one, not particularly close. Della open a -335 favorite, -460 right now. Roberts open +275, +340. Bringing it home with the Tapology vote. Surprise to us there, to you. I'm going to say Della is probably a big favorite. I'm going to say over under 85% Della Maddalena.
I'll say over.
I'm going to say over. Oh my goodness. 550 total votes, 96% Della Maddalena, 86% by knockout for the 4% that have Roberts, 45% by decision, 40% by knockout. I think Della wins the fight, but my goodness, I'm surprised where the fan vote is.
It's just the way that Della fights is kind of that car crash mentality of I will eat a shot to give a shot. Danny Roberts doesn't really have that level of durability at this stage in his career, I don't think, to get into that kind of a fight. And he's not a good enough wrestler to just decide, oh, we're not striking right now. Because like you said, when Della is going to face adversity, is you're going to either have to bring the fight to him and really pressure him and make him feel uncomfortable, or pressure him with your wrestling and not allow him to really initiate his own boxing combinations. Roberts can go for takedowns, but he's not a specialist in that regard by any means. So I don't think he's a good enough grappler for grappling's sake. I think he can make it competitive in some spots, but I like the striking out of Della quite a bit in this
fight. To me, going back and watching that fight that Mike Perry had, Perry withstood a lot of damage in that fight, and then he just kept coming forward. He lands that hand, wobbles Danny Roberts, and he grabs his head and slams it into his knee, and he gets the knockout. But for Roberts, he's been dropped by Dominic Steele, Mike Perry, Nurdin Taleb, Michelle Pereira. So for me, I have Jack Della Maddalena, the varied attack, the boxing combinations, the power, and the speed, and he tends to have a pretty decent gas tank. So both of us going with Jack Della in the matchup. Let us know who you have down below in the comment section. Some big fights left on this card, including a main event between Derek Lewis and Sergey Spivak. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Middleweight finishers looking to approach the ranks. Coming up this weekend, we have Factory X Muay Thai's Cody Brundage taking on a guy who could write a book on the ADCC based on his experience. It's Rodolfo Vieira, formerly known as the Black Belt Hunter. Doesn't really go by that moniker anymore after a purple belt submitted him in MMA. That's Fluffy Hernandez. But for Rodolfo Vieira, such an interesting case because he's that perfect mix of wrestling and grappling. He's a guy that can take you down and submit you very, very quickly. And for Vieira, if you look at it, the speed bumps in the UFC, he is 3-2. The losses, of course, to the aforementioned Anthony Hernandez. And his last time out, he took on Chris Curtis in a fight where was Rodolfo favored to win? Not necessarily. In that one, had decent success in the first round. He really did. And his striking looked much improved. The second round was fairly close, but Curtis winning out. And in the third round, it was a lot of panic takedowns out of Vieira. And if you're, again, of that Dominic Cruz judging criteria, it leaves a bad look in the judges' minds. If you have a bad third round, Vieira went 0 of 10 on takedown attempts. A lot of them were really labored, and then he kind of sit down and Curtis would pod him a little bit. It wasn't much of a performance there in the third, but the striking did look better first round, second round against a guy who is a very good striker.
And that's what I wanted to talk about. Like, for Rodolfo, this might be me being too optimistic about his loss, but tell me if I'm talking crazy right now. I thought he looked more confident in his striking against Chris Curtis, and I thought that was important. Just because he didn't win the exchanges doesn't tell the whole story. It's tough to go out there and outstrike a guy like Chris Curtis when you are not a natural striker. But what we saw in Rodolfo was he wasn't running away from the exchanges. He didn't look uncomfortable on his feet. And I think that is the first step you have have to make to then getting that part
to
your game.
He didn't look like he was scared of expending his gas tank or getting finished. And if you look at it for Vieira, okay, let's go through his UFC fights really quick. So he fights...
People might hear that and think, oh, well, he's at the UFC level, but it's true. A lot of MMA fighters are skilled. A lot of MMA fighters have trouble with their cardio, though. And when you're tired, it doesn't really matter how skilled of a fighter you are.
You saw that for him in his first loss, but he beats Oscar Piotr really quickly. He then beats Saparbek Safarov. Fairly quickly gets his eyes swollen up, but he jumps on, gets a submission. He loses to Hernandez, has a great first round, and then has no cardio left in the second. Then he fights Dustin Stoicevus in a bit of a stinker at the start because Vieira was almost fighting a conserve's gas tank. From the outside, throwing a couple combinations here and there, waiting, not really doing a whole lot. And then in the third round, just flipped the switch and got the submission. And then against Chris Curtis, one of the more dangerous fighters you're going to face in striking in the middleweight division, and that's not a hot take, he went out there and struck for striking's sake. Now, for Cody Brundage, you look at it. I mean, he was a good wrestler when he was in high school. He was a good wrestler when he was in college as well. In high school, Matt, this was his total ledger.
Is it like Wilt Chamberlain-esque?
Well, I mean, it was 128-22, so it's pretty damn good. He was a two-time Division II qualifier at Newbury College at 197 and 285 pounds. So he wrestled in the higher weight classes. Brundage fought on Dana White's Contender Series and lost to William Knight, a fight that he was having success in with the striking and the wrestling until he got submitted. But Brundage in the UFC is an interesting case, and I'll out myself right now. Cody Brundage has fought three times in the UFC, and I picked him to win three times.
Oh, really? I didn't know this.
And I've been right on two of those. But I thought that he had a really competitive fight and a short-notice debut at 205 pounds against Nick Maximov, or at least at 185, rather, against Nick Maximov. In that fight, it was an interesting case where he had success with the striking, he had success in some of the grappling, but he ultimately didn't win a lot of the minutes on the ground, and judges favored the control time and the takedowns of Maximo. But he goes out there against Dalcin Jambula.
Looks bad until he doesn't.
If you thought Alex Pereira looked good at 185, winning in the fifth round against Israel Adesanya, go watch the first round of Cody Brundage and Dalcin Jambula. Linjambula wins in every aspect of MMA. He's beating him up against the cage. Dalcin goes for a double leg takedown, wraps the arms behind the butt. Cody grabs the guillotine and pulls guard at the same time. And he's able to just pull on, hold on for dear life. Performance bonus there. His last time out, he didn't get a bonus, but he's taking on Trayshawn Gore. As the round's going on, Gore's stalking him, but Brundage is boxing well. And we've seen improvements as he's gone from Scorpion Fighting Systems in his native Michigan to going over to Factory X Muay Thai, where Brundage is based right now. But he explodes, hits Gore with the right hand, drops him, gets into top, and sleeps him with ground and pound, gets up, and he says, and I want to make sure I get this one right, I thought we were wrestling. They weren't wrestling.
What I really like out of Cody Brundage is when he went to Factory X, he didn't become a completely different fighter. He just added a lot more to the fighter than he originally was. And that's what I like out of him. Are his combinations now crazy, like Carlos Condit-esque in his prime? No, not at all. But he throws a lot of varied attacks on the feet. He can throw a lot of different boxing combinations. And that's what I do like out of Cody Brundage. And he does feel like one of those fighters to where, okay, if his level of wrestling and his level of striking do finally reach the same place, you can put them together, I think he will be really difficult fighter, because you do see flashes. Like, I remember being very impressed of his, like, Hail Mary win over Dalcin, because that's not a win you see every day. A guy gets beat pillar to post, and then just,
like, you gotta think, like, he was almost finished on the feet a couple of times.
Yeah, like, he was out of it, and then all of a sudden gets this really impressive submission, and it was okay. You were able to do that over Dalcin, who, let's be honest, is probably closer to the end of his career than the beginning. Let's give you Trayshawn Gore, a guy who's sort of the opposite, a guy who has a lot that he could show us, but we're still kind of left asking more. Cody Brundage was able to go out there and show us another part of his game that was still more impressive. So for Brundage, I do feel like he is a fighter who continues to add to his game continuously, whereas Vera's in a very different boat. He is that refined game, but he's learning how to put a game plan together, and I think that's what's really been important for him. Rodolfo in the fight against Dustin Stoicevus, if you just look at the third round submission, you might think, oh, he has great cardio. That's not the case at all. It's the amount of work he puts in until he can finally go for that submission. If Vieira is willing to just stand on the outside, not throw a lot of strikes, just be elusive on the outside, which sounds wild for a guy as big as he is, but if he does just sort of use his footwork, get in and out of range, well, he's not burning a lot of energy. Anybody can dance dances around and bounces around on their feet for 10 minutes is when he gets into those elongated grappling exchanges where he can't actually get a finish. That's when those muscles really start to fill up with lactic acid and he starts to really diminish as the fight continues.
Vieira had a lot of success outside of the UFC, multiple time ADCC champ, ultimate champ, so on and so forth. Cody Brundage, lights out champ at middleweight and light heavyweight. He beat Eric Lozano, who was 13-15, and then he beat Eric Lozano was 13-16, back-to-back, two different titles. But for Brundage, it'll be interesting to see, just for both of these guys, where they square off. Because physically, you might think that Vieira's going to have a giant advantage. Vieira definitely looks drawn out when he cuts to 185, and Brundage maybe not the same. So I'm eager to see these two guys when they step into the cage, eager to see this one on Friday. The odds coming in on this one, Vieira open minus 145, minus 180 right now, Brundage open plus 125, plus 145. We have a look at the topology votes, Matt. Surprise to us, they are to you. Brundage has been an underdog in his UFC fights, and I just keep picking Brundage as an underdog, and I don't think the fans tend to like him all that much. I'm going to say over under 75% Vieira here.
I think it'll be under.
Think it's going to be under? Oh, slightly under. 581 total votes, 71% Vieira, 84% by submission. For the 29% that are Brundage, 53% by knockout. Matt, I look at this fight, and I look at Rodolfo Vieira's fight against Vitaly Nemchinov over with ACA, his fight right before he came into the UFC, where he walks across the cage, spears into a double leg, his opponent flips his back, being a wrestler, gives his back, and then Vieira gets a rear naked choke. I think Vieira's going to do that in this fight and submit Cody Brundage.
The thing is, when you look at everything Cody Brundage excels at and really just break it down basic, well, he's probably a better striker. He has more variety in his strikes.
He's got a really tight 1-2 that's exactly. Really efficient, and his leg kick's great.
Exactly. So on the feet, I would assume Brundage is going to win a lot of the minutes. In the pure wrestling, especially if it goes late, I would assume Brundage is the better pure wrestler, but you brought it up to open the video. Normally when we talk about pure jiu-jitsu fighters, it's, hey, they might be good at striking, sometimes they're not, sometimes they're incredible at striking, look at Charles Oliveira. Most of the time, though, they struggle with the wrestling. There's some guys, think of Glover, think of Jacare. Like, there are a few guys out there who are so physically strong that they've been able to work on the wrestling throughout enough time to be able to add the wrestling along with the submission game. Rodolfo Vieira is one of those guys, and I do think that he will be able to get the takedown on Cody Brundage. I think that's the biggest thing. Brundage, if he can defend that takedown and elongate this fight, then yes, he's going to be able to make Rodolfo work and be a lesser version of himself as it continues. But I agree wholeheartedly with your breakdown. Once Brundage does hit the mat, I do think he's going to struggle with some of that grappling defense. People might joke about Fluffy Hernandez, but like, he's a legit fighter at this stage of his career, so a loss to him is no shame whatsoever. So I do expect Rodolfo to look good in this matchup.
Can he play baseball? Can he play? I mean, my goodness, Fluffy Hernandez. Both of us going with Rodolfo Vieira to get the win. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have in this matchup. Little Birdie told me we had a Muslim Salikov fight coming up next. The king of kung fu. You're not going to want to miss that. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
This weekend on the main card of UFC Fight Night, Lewis versus Spivak, we have a matchup in the welterweight division pitting the king of kung fu, Muslim Salikov, the Wushu Sanda, I don't know, just ultimate version. Like, this guy is one of the best Wushu Sanda practitioners ever. He was the gold medalist at the 2008 Beijing Olympics appendage tournament that they had over there. But he really is to the nth degree of striking. He had four spinning finish knockout wins before he came into the UFC in a row, headlined by a Melvin Gallard win. And in the UFC, it's been a little bit of a mixed bag, but 18-3 as the record. He lost his last time out against Li Jingliang. Looked great in the first round, out-grappled Li Jingliang. You're saying, Craig, did a striker out-grapple Li Jingliang? It happened.
You could win the battle and lose the war, though. And he did bite on a lot of those body jabs that Li Jingliang was able to land. And if you watch the finish of that fight, oh my goodness, it was violent.
It was. And for Andrea Fialu, I mean, this is a guy that you've known and loved over with Bellator. If you're excited for Beast in 25 out, Vadim Nemkov later on this week, you probably know about Andrea Fialu. He was featured in co-main events, main card slots over with Bellator. He fought with the PFL, with LFA, with UAE Warriors. And coming into the UFC in 2021... he went 4-0 and looked absolutely amazing. Made a short notice debut earlier on this year. Lost to Michelle Pereira on the main card of a pay-per-view, but made it relatively competitive. There might have been 30s, 27s out there, but he did make it competitive. He then went out and picked up two giant knockout wins his next two times out. And then his last time out, took on Jake Matthews, who was final form Jake Matthews.
and looked like the best version we've ever seen.
And I think we've seen a similar story play out for both these guys in the UFC up until this point. I think when they're able to strike on their terms, when they're the ones moving forward, we've seen just how effective both these guys are. But I think that they both struggle with similar versions of a fighter. Just when they get backed up, I find both guys turn into more of a single striker than a volume striker, where Fiallo has great power. And what I really like out of, I like baseball, I like Aaron Judge. What I liked out of Aaron Judge this season was he didn't try to hit home runs. He said, hey, I'm 6'8". If I just swing for average and hit the ball.
I think he spent about 2 weeks trying to hit home runs to break the Roger Maris record.
He hit 330 and almost won the Triple Crown. So I'm pretty sure my point is good. My point is, he just went for average. And if you hit the ball more times, it gives you more chances to hit a home run. When Fiallo's at his best, it's when he's throwing a lot of shots, because he does have a natural power in his own hands. So when you throw a lot of shots, you just give yourself a better chance to become a knockout artist. What I didn't like in the performance against Jake Matthews was, once Matthews was able to back him up, I found he was just trying to find that one single shot a little bit more and time it. And if he's doing that against a guy like Salikov, not to say he couldn't land that one shot, but that is going to allow Salikov to just get into his own flow and become that unique kind of striker. The weird thing that I have in this fight, though, is we both really hyped up Muslim Salikov fights every single time. It's always, oh, do we put it in the fight of the night? It has been a while since we have really seen him open up with his game and become that creative and aggressive striker that we have once saw. So I think there's a version out there where if Salikov is on his A game, really moving around well and being an aggressive striker, I think he could have success. It's just been a while since I've really seen him be dedicated to that game plan. So it's tough for me to think, wow, he's going to go back and become that.
I had to throw all of the bias out on this fight because I get very excited about Andrea Fiallo fights. And I've been, you know, I've let that be known on the channel, but the same can be said for Muslim Salikov. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to this fight. But then when I try and break it down, you really got to go analytically, watch the fights and take the numbers into account a little bit. And I know the judges don't have that, but it does play a lot into this fight. And I agree with you. For Fiallo, when he's walking guys down, when he's landing that left hand, that's when he's at his best. And the thing for Fiallo about his left hand is he throws it as either a jab, a left hook, or as an uppercut, and he can have tons of success when he varies that weapon. That is his best shot, and he is an orthodox fighter, so it is funny to see a guy have so much success with that lead hand versus just winging power shots with the right, which you might expect. For Fiallo, though, he isn't a giant kicker. He really does kind of rely on his boxing combinations to open up.
And
he has a ton of power. Fiallo struggles, though, when you start to enter in. You saw it when he took on Cameron Van Camp, which is kind of funny to say, and Van Camp didn't really have a great run with the UFC, but Fiallo goes and opens up with a big hook. He gets countered with a Van Camp left hook, then a right, and that puts him on baby deer legs and sends him backwards. Then in the brawl, Fiallo starts to land, and he ends up finishing Van Camp. Before that, the fight against Miguel Baeza, the fight starts off. Baeza lands a clean 1-2, and I'm talking clean that sends Fiallo just walking back, and then he walks himself back into it. Fiallo gets hit by right hands very, very often in his fights. And if you look at it from Muslim Salikov, he kind of said, like, we haven't seen that King of Kung Fu in the UFC.
It's been a minute.
And I'd agree. Like, all the spinning stuff, you see the spinning stuff, but you don't really see it land as much.
People used to get on me for having that gripe with Zabit. Like, Zabit was awesome when he was healthy, but he'd throw these crazy spinning kicks that, let's be honest, they would never land. Muslim Salikov does that a lot in his fight.
His fight against Francisco Trinaldo, he kind of just waited and baited, and then in tight, he landed that nice flurry. He drops Trinaldo at the end of the first round. But after that, this is where I really have to go with this video. Muslim Salikov, after round one, doesn't really do much, and he likes to wrestle a little bit more. And we saw it against Xing Liang. He wanted to wrestle quite a bit in the first round. You're 38 years old. Like, that's an energy system that I know the training that he has, the guys that he trains with, he works a lot of his wrestling. When you're the Wushu Sanda champ, you're going to have to defend some takedowns. Yeah. Now, Wushu Sanda is kickboxing with takedowns, but people are going to try and take you down. And obviously, Alex Garcia was able to kind of win out in that realm. And that was Salikov's first UFC fight. But Salikov, as it goes, 14 of his 18 wins are by finish. 13 of those 14 finish wins are in round number one. So as this fight goes on, I think it favors Fiallo. Now, for Fiallo, we touched on it. I mean, he got chinned in his last fight against Jake Matthews, which was back in June. Salikov got TKO'd back in July against Li Jingliang. Now, was he out completely? No, he was covering up, but referee ended it. Fiallo was more finished than
Salikov
was.
They were both pretty hurt.
Neither one were all that good. But for Fiallo, what does he really, really struggle with? The Pereira fight, he got out volume, but he was in on super short notice. I don't really count that one that much. The fight against Jake Matthews, he got completely outstruck in every respect.
But before that, it was grappling. Like the Chris Curtis fight, Glycoe France over with the PFL, he really did. And even when he was with Bellator, it really was grapple-heavy attacks is where he would struggle. And Fialho has been a guy out of Black Zillion, Sanford, friggin' Hard Knocks, Killcliff FC that it is right now. And they talk about it in every broadcast. He is of the school of Henry Hooft. He really is a Hooft type of fighter because everything's tight with a lot of power. Very and he employs those really tactical things that you see Hooft fighters employ. So Fialho struggles with the takedown. Could Salikov take advantage of it? Sure. If he took down Li Jingliang, he could take down Andrea Fialho. For me, not even looking at the odds in the fan vote, I think Fialho wins in the second round, the third round, he picks up as this fight goes on. And it hurts me to say it.
No, I agree, because that's the thing. Could Salikov win this fight? Yes, he could. But I'm trusting a guy who's almost 40 years old to become a fighter that he hasn't been for a number of years now. And I like the win he has over Eliseo Zaleski dos Santos. Is it that impressive of a win, though, after you go back and watch the fight? Not at all. He didn't have some Max Griffin knock him down, drag him out war with Eliseo. They stood there and looked at each other for 15 minutes and didn't throw a damn thing. Let's just call it what it is. That was a fight I was very excited for that did not live up to the hype whatsoever. It just feels like with Salikov, it's the threat of what he's going to do more than what he's actually going to do. And yes, Fialho does leave himself very open for some of those counter shots. He could definitely be hit by them, like you said. He's been hit clean even in the fights where he's won and looked very good in. But I do still like him for his overall activity. And the last thing too is, but a decade younger too. That has to be brought up. Like, not that Fialho's some spring chicken by any means. He's definitely had some damage in his career, but Muslim Salikov is not a young man at this stage of his life by any means.
Yeah, Salikov coming off that loss to Li Jingliang. I mean, the only other loss on his career, he lost to Chris Holcomb in 2012 by submission and Alex Garcia by submission, a guy who trained out of Montreal, Quebec, Canada when he's in the UFC. The odds on this one, Salikov's the favorite, minus 130, Fialho plus 106 underdog, and the fan vote, 59% going with Fialho to get the win, 81% by knockout for the 41% that have Salikov. What is that? 68% by decision. I think Fialho wins by decision. He's the underdog, and that doesn't agree with the fans, but both of us going with Andrea Fialho in this fight.
But I could see a stoppage either way, if I'm being completely honest. Like, I agree with you. I do favor Fialho, especially if it goes late. I like his output. I like his activity, but he definitely leaves himself open enough to where if Salikov decides to become the fighter from a few years ago, he definitely has an opportunity to get the stoppage, but this should be an incredible fight for as long as it lasts.
Both of us going with Portugal the man. I feel it. Like,
feel it still.
Going with Andrea Fialho to get the win. Some big time fights on this card, including Waldo Cortez Acosta taking on Chase Sherman. That one's up next. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it.
Yeah, Cortez is a very awkward fighter, a former MMA fighter. He doesn't really have a style. He's big, he's strong.
A turn and burn type of fight for the DRs. Waldo Cortez Acosta. He's going by the nickname of Salsa Boy at this point. He's going to be taking on a short notice fighter, but who was already ready for a fight. It is the Vanilla Gorilla Chase Sherman. Now, I want to make sure I get these dates right. UFC win number one for Cortez Acosta came on October 29th. He got a decision win over Jared Vandera. That was Chase Sherman's last win as well, was Vandera. But if you look at it for Sherman, he was due to take on Josh Parisian on November the 5th. So both of these guys either competed or were supposed to compete in the very, very not-so-distant past. And if you look at it for Chase Sherman, weighed in successfully, had the face-off with Parisian on the day of the fight, Parisian out due to health issues. So Sherman's left without a dance partner. Sherman now gets Cortez Acosta. Sherman, do Parisian, a guy who can box a bit to get on the inside to get you down to the mat. Cortez Acosta boxes, and that's it. Waldo Cortez Acosta, he boxes, and that's kind of the thing about him. I mean, I know the crazy backstory, you know, coming to the States from the Dominican, he was a pitcher in the Reds organization, skirmish in the dugout, joins, the combat sports, he goes over and fights in boxing, he's 6-4, and we had that bit of a sound clip there, that was from his last fight with Top Rank, but for Cortez Acosta, 6-4 in boxing, 3 wins by knockout, 3 losses by knockout. And his last fight, he took on a guy, and I want to make sure that I mention this and I get this one right. He took on a guy named Sonny Kanto. I talked about Sonny Kanto last week in our videos, Matt. He's Andre Petrosky's training partner. He's a boxer out of Philly, and Sonny Kanto is undefeated at 11-0 at this point. And in that fight, Kanto worked behind the jab, pushed Waldo back. Waldo's stance in boxing is the exact same as his stance in MMA. So in boxing, he didn't have to defend the kicks, brother. And in that fight, Kanto works the jab, backs up Cortez Acosta until he's almost in a corner of the ring, throws a jab, and then at a certain point, Cortez Acosta brings both hands up like this, and Sonny just throws a right cross right down the middle, and it drops Cortez Acosta, who can't get up off the mat at all for the count, and he ends up getting knocked out in that one. Comes back over to MMA after that foray in boxing, that loss was in 2021, and then picks up where he left off. Undefeated in MMA, fights Thomas Peterson for the LFA title, wins that fight. He's losing not every minute of every round, but he's losing that fight handily. And then for him, it's a straight right down the pipe that wobbles Peterson. He ends up dropping him, face planting him, winning. Goes on Dana White's Contender Series this past summer, fights Danilo Suzarchi. He's a big favorite in that fight, almost a 4-1 favorite. Looked really good in that fight. Takes on Vandera, looks great in the first round, doesn't know how to check a leg kick. Round two, round three, little bit off the rails. You'd say one round two, round three he didn't. But for Vandera in that fight, in terms of the total numbers of what he landed, 56 significant strikes, 39 of those were leg kicks.
That's good, but the problem is if you're only landing leg kicks and you're not able to set anything else up after it, it does leave a little bit more to be desired. And that's why I'll be interested to see what Chase Sherman's able to do, because if you followed the career of Chase Sherman, other than the weird is he not in the UFC right now runs that he's had, he does throw very effective leg kicks offensively. It's been a part of his game even when he wasn't in the UFC after he got cut initially. He'd have some fights over in Jungle Fight. That was a big part of his game.
Island fights. He didn't go to Brazil.
Sorry, thank you. Island fights. That was a big part of his game even over there. And we'd even seen his kicking game start to evolve a little bit. He was going to the body, going to the head a little bit more. He has gone away from that, I would say. Still primarily more of a leg kicker. But the thing about Sherman is, he does set up most things with his own boxing. He does have elbows, I will give him that. He is a decent fighter on the inside. But the thing about Chase Sherman that is the biggest red flag I could possibly plant in the ground is, he fights, we'd say how Luke Rockhold pulls back with his chin up. Chase Sherman is a heavyweight version of that, but he'll do it in the pocket. He is a guy who will pursue offense at the decline of defense. And against a guy like Cortez Acosta, who, yes, I think the leg kicks are going to land against him. I think the movement, oddly enough, of Chase Sherman might give him troubles early too. I just don't know how much Chase Sherman's going to be able to do off of the leg kicks. Because let's say he does land the leg kicks. At a certain point, he's going to have to get into that boxing range with Cortez Acosta. And yes, maybe he can use the clinch to then get some dirty boxing and use his elbows. Make this an MMA fight more than just a boxing fight. But the one thing I do like out of Cortez Acosta that gives him a good sign as a guy being as big as he is you don't see guys throw boxing combinations at his size in the UFC. Normally when you have bigger heavyweights or kind of at the limit, they wing a lot of power shots, whereas Cortez Acosta will stay composed and stay technical on the inside, which you do like to see.
Yeah, like I say, you lose to Sonny Kondo, you get knocked out in 2021, and that's not great for your boxing career, but what does it have to do with MMA? If you look at the way that Cortez Acosta boxes in MMA, it's better than guys in the heavyweight division. His combinations are good. He goes to the body and to the head. He'll rip, lead hooks to the body and then come up.
Too.
He's really big for the division as well. I mean, 6'4". Again, both of these guys, same height, same reach, but Cortez Acosta is going to weigh in a little bit heavier. But when you look at it for Cortez Acosta, like, we were talking about him like the next Chris Daukaus in the division, like a guy who could really go on a run.
What does that mean, though?
I'm completely stunted on his growth after that fight against Jared Vandera. Vandera had quite literally a leg to stand on to having won that fight. You could have scored at 29-28 either way. For Chase Sherman, his fight against Vandera, first round, Sherman, second round, Vandera, third round was Vandera until Sherman unleashed with the combination that finished him. But for Sherman, my big point is when you do just want to talk about leg kicks and boxing combinations, which are his specialty, the leg kicks against Ike Villanueva, he had a welt on the front of his shin at the end of the first round. At the second round, he ends up finishing him. The fight against Parker Porter, 33 leg kicks. The fight against Arlovski, 17. And the fight that Sherman had against Vandera, he landed 19 in that fight. If you do look at it, the thing that does scare me out of Sherman, not just pull back, but Mark Madsen dips to the right all the time. Mark Madsen, dipping to the right, working his boxing. Chase Sherman dips to the right in the pocket,
closes off,
which is scary against Waldo Cortez Acosta, whose right hand is his biggest weapon. So that does give me cause for concern.
It's just my big problem is, unless Sherman can get a finish based off the leg kicks, I do think it's going to be difficult for him to get a lot of that in-between work done on the inside. Because I do think Cortez Acosta, since he does keep his hands very high and he is throwing a lot of his own boxing combinations, it's going to be difficult for Sherman to find those in-betweens to decide, okay, now I'm in defense mode. Now I can initiate my own offense. I just think it's going to be an interesting fight for Sherman, but I totally agree with what you had said. I was with you. I thought Cortez Acosta had a decent ceiling. It's always difficult to tell in the heavyweight division.
I'm not even joking. Like, top 15, like 15 to 10. Like, we're going to fight Shamil Abdurakhimov in 6 months.
But again, my big point is, and again, I don't disagree with you at all, how much higher in the division is Chase Sherman than a guy like Jared Vandera? Because again, he is higher than him in the division because he has the win over him.
But just because you had a close fight with Jared Vandera doesn't now make me think, okay, Chase Sherman's going to blow the doors off you. And this is no disrespect to Chase Sherman, but up until his last fight, he wasn't on the greatest run of his career. And I do feel like with his obvious strengths and obvious weaknesses, I just think this is a difficult fight to predict. Because like you had said, the obvious defensive liabilities of Chase Sherman play into the strengths of Cortez Acosta. And the fact that Cortez Acosta very much is a boxer who's been transitioning into MMA does leave him limited in a lot of the other aspects of his game.
Sherman getting ready for Parisian, who's going to tier his layers. He's going to work in the takedowns. Well, Cortez Acosta's not a grappler. And likewise for Cortez Acosta, Sherman's not a grappler. Cortez Acosta struggles with the takedown defense in some of his fights. You have a look at the odds here. Cortez Acosta open a minus 160 favorite, minus 185 as it stands. Sherman open a plus 140, plus 160. We have a look at the Topology votes, Matt. Surprise to us, they are to you. In 2017, the Vanilla Gorilla was the hotness as the gift king. But he's not now. I'm going to say over under 70% Salsa Boy.
I think it'll be over.
And it is way over. 411 total votes, 81% Cortez Acosta, 24% by decision, 71% by knockout for the 19% that have Sherman, 43% by decision, 51% by knockout. You don't get better at checking leg kicks in 2-3 weeks, let alone having an opponent just thrown at you this quick, because you have to focus. Like, this fight was only made in the last couple of weeks. For Chase Sherman, that's his bread and butter, but defensive liabilities you also don't fix in one camp or two camp, and he's had 26 pro fights. So this one's a lot harder to pick than the fan vote and the odds would suggest, I would say.
It is, but I do find myself picking the only slightly younger, I was going to say much younger, Cortez Acosta, because this is the thing. Unless Chase Sherman's able to hit him with one of those leg kicks that can compromise him enough where you get a stumble, you get like one of those knockdowns, you know what I mean. Like one of the leg kicks where the second it lands, you know, significant damage has been made. I don't know how much success Sherman can have in the boxing and with his own kickboxing on the inside and the outside. Again, I think the clinch, if he's able to utilize that, could be a big tool for him. I'm going all the way back to the Daywalker times when he finished with an elbow.
Let me add to it, because the Daywalker, that was the last fight that Sherman had won that wasn't in the first round, and he's got what? How many? Like, all but one of his wins are by finish, and then he had one, if not two, that were after the first round. So Chase Sherman's a first-round guy. What I loved out of his last fight against Jared Vandera was the fact that that was in the third round. Second round, he's still throwing good volume. Power and volume were still there in the third round. I like what I saw there. Whereas for Cortez Acosta, the clinch is different because you're not holding on.
I just don't think Cortez Acosta has to worry about the takedown.
The kicks are different. He doesn't have to worry about the takedown. If you haven't figured it out, I have Chase Sherman in the matchup. I mean, I think the boxing's there. The kicks are there. Cortez Acosta, if he wins, first round knockout. And that's not controversial.
I think you do in the second.
After that, I don't see Cortez Acosta winning the fight by finish. So I have Chase Sherman here. Matt going with Salsa Boy to keep that undefeated
record.
But
I agree with you wholeheartedly, where we do kind of have to reassess what Cortez Acosta's ceiling is. Just because I'm picking him in this fight doesn't mean I think he's going to become some world beater. Again, if he shows me something new, let's see if he goes out there and throws a nice leg kick. Just adds that one little wrinkle to his game that gives you confidence that he can continue to add different parts to it. That would just be a nice sign to see. But I really like that point that you had brought up about how this was a guy who felt like he had a lot of hype, but even though he got the result that you look for, he got the win, you still kind of have to reassess where you think he's going to go in the future.
Split on the pick. Let us know who you have down below in the comment section. Some big fights left on this card, including Derek Lewis and Sergey Spivak in the main event in this weight class. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Coming up this weekend, the Hulk Experience continues. And if you've ever ridden that roller coaster at Universal Studios, you know it's a lot of fun. But for Iwan Kutsalaba and his bank account, it's been anything but that. He takes on Kennedy Nzechukwu coming up this weekend. And for Nzechukwu, he's been on a tidy little run in his last five fights, and we'll discuss both of these guys' recent results, but this really is a fun fight because for Nzechukwu, you knew exactly what you could have at a certain point when you saw him on Dana White's Contender Series the first time. This guy has such a large frame for the division. If he could figure out that mix of the power with the length and the range, he could really go far, and this is his great opportunity. For him, his last time out against Carl Robertson, I mean, they didn't belong in the same octagon. It didn't seem. For Nzechukwu, in the last five fights, you look at the wins that he has. A win over Carlos Ulberg by finish, withstood a heavy storm, came out the other side. Danilo Marquez withstood the heavy grappling storm early until Marquez got tired, finished him. Took on Dion Jung and did not respond to the power very well. Lost a split decision to Nikolai Nguimerianu. And in that fight now, fellow teammate of Iwan Kutsalaba at Extreme Couture, so they can exchange notes and have a little bit of fun there. But for Kennedy, he lost a point really early on in that fight, and even if he didn't, He probably should have won that fight. So his last time out against Robertson, very impressive that he was able to finish them, especially down and dirty like he did. And for Iwan Kutsalaba, the last five fights, as just a sample size, a loss to Magomed Ankalaev. That was the second one. There was no worries about that one. A split decision or a split draw against Dustin Jacoby, 10-8 first round. And then he didn't have the cardio in the second, third rounds. He beats Devin Clark by decision, completely out-wrestled him, and looked amazing on the mat. He lost to Ryan Spann by submission, where he just looked like, not a fish out of water, but I say this with respect. He was just kind of floating everywhere, all over, being super, you know, unorthodox. And as he runs in to try and get the takedown, Ryan Spann just cranks and gets him into the submission. And then, of course, Kutsalaba's last time out, takes on Johnny Walker. And apparently, all they do at SBG is train ground fighting, and Johnny Walker is a submission specialist. So that was a giant surprise of a loss for Kutsalaba, more so than any of his other fights that we've seen so far.
Without a doubt, because if you thought Kutsalaba had any one area of his game that he'd be able to go to have success, it would probably be the offensive wrestling.
That was why I took him to beat Johnny Walker, and didn't I look like a schmuck?
Like, I thought, okay, Walker might not be the best point of his career. There's a good chance he could win this fight, but we're probably going to see a crazy flying knee. You know, one of those classic Johnny Walker performances. To Walker's credit, though, and this is what you have to do. Give Johnny Walker the credit. Don't discredit Iwan Kutsalaba. Walker was able to show us a part of his game that we had yet to see against high-level competition. It was extremely impressive to see him go out there and get a submission. But it was also a little disappointing to see Kutsalaba struggle in the one area against a fighter who has never really shown that to be a strength of his. And for Kutsalaba, I'm going to be curious to see how aggressive he is in this fight, because we're kind of joking around before we started filming. Kutsalaba is always going to look good in a couple areas, but there's always going to be that one thing where he leaves you wanting more, that kind of final missing puzzle piece, because sometimes he'll have decent cardio when he doesn't throw his power punches. Sometimes he has terrible cardio when he does throw his power punches. But I gotta be honest, and maybe this is a bit of a zag, I like the former aggressive version of Kutsalaba a little bit more than the slow burn version that we've got as of late. I know that Kutsalaba is more well-rounded than anybody gives him credit for, because everybody just thinks, oh, the Hulk, he's gonna go in there and throw power shots. And yes, to a certain degree, you are correct. But Kutsalaba is a good offensive grappler. He's dynamic on the mat. The problem is, it's almost like he doesn't really realize what version of himself he should be in a lot of these fights, and that's what's so great about this fight in general, I think. For Kennedy, he also kind of has that on and off switch, but what I like out of Kennedy, and you had mentioned it, he has such a unique skill set for his frame in this division. He has good cardio, but he's massive, he's very long and rangy, has good power sometimes when he sits down on his shots, but again, for Kennedy, he's a guy who really thrives in that long range, and against a guy like Iwan Kutsalaba, who can struggle at finding his entries with his own power shots, Kennedy could have a lot of success. But the flip side is, once guys do get on the inside of that range, make it ugly on him, mix in their wrestling, or at least their clinch work with their own striking, guys can start to get towards him and start landing their own shots, because even though we beat Carlos Ahlberg, you kind of forgot about how we got to that, finish. Carlos Ahlberg was beating him up pretty bad for the first few minutes of that fight, like landing big power shots, and it was just that Kennedy is so durable, he was able to weather that big storm, get to the other side, and show off some of his unique skill sets. I just think this is a really fun fight between two guys who I think do have high ceilings, but they both desperately need this win if they want to maintain the relevancy.
And I mean, Nzechukwu's biggest fight that he's had just happens to be his UFC debut against Paul Craig. If we're talking about the divisional rankings and the relevance that it has to the matchup, I mean, for Nzechukwu, that is a guy. And for Iwan Kutsalaba, I'd say as win over Khalil Roundtree, or possibly even Devin Clark. I mean, the losses to Ankalaev, you have to think at a certain point, Ankalaev will most likely fight for a title in the next year. I'm going to say that. So for Iwan, yeah, those are tough losses against a tall, long, rangy striker who throws some really good kicks. So we'll see how this one plays out. But style for style, and Nzechukwu can kind of mold himself to the fight that's brought to him. Kutsalaba doesn't really do well under those same pressures. When somebody starts to bring their own brand of fight to him, he can kind of struggle and change his game plan as the fight goes on.
But that's why I like this fight so much. Kennedy's style of fight is accept what's given to him and then retaliate with his own. That means he's going to face the big storm from Iwan Kutsalaba early in this fight, and that's why I do think this is one of those fights where if Kutsalaba wins, it's probably going to be by knockout early, because we have seen Kennedy face power punchers who do start to decline, especially if they
they've been throwing power punches early, and if Cutelapa does find himself being that huffing and puffing striker who is reaching for some of his takedowns, because that is the one thing with Cutelapa, when he has full cardio, his takedowns are quite explosive. They do get labored as the fight continues, though, and I think that's one area that Kennedy can have a lot of success in, if he is able to at least weather that big storm. But again, we're asking you to just eat power shots for a guy like Ion Cutelapa, who, like, 3 years ago was thought of as, like, the boogeyman of this division.
I mean, just finishing Khalil Roundtree with elbows and mount, now ranked Khalil Roundtree. So you look at the odds in this matchup. Cutelapa, well, they both open a par. He's now the underdog, plus 140, and Zechiku now at a minus 170. We'll have a look at the fan vote. Surprise to us, it is to you over on Topology. I'm going to say over-under. I guess if Nzechiku is that big of a favorite, I'll say over under 65% Kennedy Nzechiku.
I think it'll be over.
It's under, but it's close. So 520 total votes, 66% Nzechiku, 78% by knockout. For the 34% that have Cutelapa, 61% by knockout. So most people see a finish. Most people see a knockout. Who's it going to be for, I guess?
I think if the fight's not absolutely terrible, we will get a finish. Like, I think if both guys are just so hesitant about their opponent's power, we probably will get a finish. Because if Cutelapa does go in there and have the best chance of success that I think he does, which is really rough up in Nzechiku, make him think, especially early on, and make him feel your power early, then Cutelapa's not going to be there in round two and round three to really withstand the storm if Kennedy's able to get past it. So I think this is a really fun fight just because it could go any which way. I guess I will favor the cardio of Kennedy in this matchup. Here's the thing, too. I think his grappling defense has gotten better throughout his UFC tenure.
Like, if you consider Cutelapa and compare him to the now recently heavyweight, or, yeah, wasn't a heavyweight title challenger? Light heavyweight title challenger over KSW, Darko Stuzic. Stuzic was able to close the distance, go again and again and again. And there's a lot of similarities between those two guys. But if you look at that fight, and then the Marquez fight, and then the fight against Nikolai, Kennedy has gotten a lot better at defending a lot of those entries.
And I think that's why I will end up predicting him in this fight. I think this is a very fun co-main event. For all those Carlos Felipe versus unranked heavyweight X ones, I know these two guys might not be the biggest names in the world, but I really do think entertainment-wise, this fight's going to deliver. But I do have Kennedy in the matchup.
But if you remember that Darko Stuzic fight, the reason that Nzechiku won that one was because of multiple cup checks and points taken away. And for Ion Cutelapa, he doesn't really throw kicks to the body like that. He doesn't throw those kicks in and around the groinal area.
He's not as active as Darko, though.
No, he's not like that. But with his striking, with his takedowns, he is a lot more active. So for those reasons, I like Cutelapa in the matchup, and I like how threatening he can be once the fight touches the mat. So I'm going to go with the underdog in the matchup with Ion Cutelapa, Matt going with Kennedy and Nzechiku to get the win in this matchup. This should be a great fight, and I can't wait to hear from the folks in the comments on this one. Please let us know down below who you have in this matchup. Can't wait for this one on Saturday. The main event, Derek Lewis, Sergey Spivak. We're almost there, folks. Tune in for that one. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Main event of this weekend's Fight Night card from the UFC Apex, you have the all-time knockout leader in UFC history, Derek Lewis, taking on a premier grappler in this heavyweight division in Moldova's former WWFC champ, Sergey the Polar Bear Spivak. And for Spivak, it's been a really interesting run of late. His best win on his UFC record isn't even one that he had in the last year. He beat Taito Iwasa, and he absolutely ground him out and looked amazing in that fight. The last five fights, he beat Jared Vandera, beat Alexei Olenek, looked really good with the striking in that fight. Lost to Tom Aspinall very quickly. He then beat Greg Hardy by ground and pound, and Augusto Sakai backed him up and looked great in that fight. And for Spivak, his best number on his ledger is the fact that he's number one in UFC heavyweight history, above Curtis Blaydes in takedown accuracy at 63.6%. Now, Blaydes has the most takedowns in UFC history. And Spivak is actually sitting, in and around sixth place. But you do look at it for him. He's actually seventh all-time in heavyweight history, tied with Frank Mir and Jake O'Brien with 21 takedowns in his 21 UFC tenure. But for Spivak, he's gotten better with his hands as UFC's tenure has gone on. And he's gone from being that guy out of Moldova that's a really good grappler to going over to Extreme Couture, rounding it out with a lot of really good fighters. And we've talked about in the last couple of weeks about these Eastern Europeans that have gone to Extreme Couture. Negomarianu being one of them. But also you have in the co-main event on this card, fellow Moldovan Ion Cutelapa, who have made little bits and changes to their game and trained with some of the world's best and have gotten to get to these premier stages with this organization.
I agree with everything you said, but even Sergey Spivak's boxing coach isn't telling him go in there and work the jab and the 1-2 against Derek Lewis.
Of course not. That would just be silly.
Well, you are 100% right. Sergey Spivak's a guy who had a very obvious strength in his game. Like you said, you watch the Tai Tuivasa fight. When he gets on top of his opponent, not only can he threaten with submissions, he does stuff before he goes for the submission. He gets ground and pound. He does effective grappling. I think that's an important thing to bring up because there are some fighters who they'll grapple and they'll go for a submission, but they don't do enough damage on the in-between to really make that time worthwhile if they aren't able to then go in and at least get a really tight submission or then complete submission.
Look at a guy like Ronnie Lawrence at 135. Takedown for takedown sake and scramble and have fun.
Exactly. It's difficult to win fights if you are just a dominant grappler and not a submission-oriented grappler. But to Sergey Spivak's credit, he is a grappler who goes in pursuit of a finish. And that's a great thing to see because if he does get on top of Derek Lewis, Lewis has that classic, I'm just going to get up, because you might look at him and not think he's really athletic, but it's the Javi Ayala gene. Like, Bert Kreischer has this thing where he's like, I've got the Mickey Mantle gene. I can party all night and still be great in the morning, because that's what Mickey Mantle was able to do. Derek Lewis might not look like this world-class athlete, but similar to Javi Ayala, he'll start throwing double flying knees and really catch you off guard with some of the variety of strikes that he's able to throw. I kind of hate it when he does it, though, if I'm being completely honest, because it does very much feel like it's for show. He'll throw, like, 2 spinning back kicks, and I'll be honest, for the size of them, they do look pretty good, but you never think in your life that Derek Lewis is going to win a fight via spinning back kick. I appreciate the fact he can, but my big point is, I just think Sergey Spivak in this fight is only thinking about ways to get this fight to the mat and the ways to close the distance to do that. I don't think we are going to see a lot of striking for striking sake from Sergey Spivak in this fight, and this might sound weird, but we might just see him shell up and try to walk forward, because even with Derek Lewis and some of the fights that he won, remember the Marcin Tybura fight? Marcin Tybura is a guy who fights quite a bit like Sergey Spivak, guys. We've talked about this a lot on this channel.
They happen to fight each other as well in the past.
But I would say 98% of their game is like almost the exact same. Tybura was having a lot of success against Derek Lewis with the forward pressure, with the takedowns, with the top control. But the thing was, he got lazy. He wasn't watching his P's and Q's in the last 5 seconds of a fight. And what Derek Lewis has been able to prove time after time after time is, it doesn't matter who won the first round. Doesn't matter who won the second, third, or fourth. If Derek Lewis hasn't been knocked out by the fifth round, he still has that fight-ending power in his hands. But the problem is, at a certain point, I can't just keep on believing you in you to land that one big shot. And I even said at the opening to this show, like, in the heavyweight division, you can keep this going for quite a while. Think about Alistair Overeem. He fought guys in the top of this division until he was in his early 40s. So for Derek Lewis to be 37, he could still have a few years of being in entertaining fights. I just don't know how much longer we're going to see him in these 5-round atmospheres fighting these young, hungry guys like Sergey
Spivak. And I have some stats to really kind of push you towards a Derek Lewis win if you want to go that way. Because if you look at the 5-on-in for Lewis, he is 2-3. The wins over Curtis Blaydes, Christakis, the loss to Cyril Gane, that was for the interim title, to Tai Tuivasa and Sergey Pavlovich. So, why would you like Derek Lewis in this matchup? Well, I'm going to tell you. The fight against Christakis' last win was at the UFC Apex. What was his last win before that, Matt? Can you tell me quickly about it? He fought Curtis Blaydes. He didn't win the first round. He had taken down, but in the second round, he lands the uppercut. That fight was at the UFC Apex. The 3 losses that he has are all in Texas. 2 of them are in Houston. 1 of them is in
Dallas. Can I be honest, though? I think he would have struggled with those guys at that point in his career no matter what. And again, if you want to say I'm wrong, I can be wrong on this. I don't necessarily think the venue has changed that much. Like, Christakis was very much unproven before he fought Derek Lewis. Cyril Gane is a championship-level fighter. I just think for a lot of these guys, there is a It doesn't have to do with the fact that it's in the Apex. It's just Derek Lewis been in a lot of these tough fights. Like, Sean Jordan knocked him out a decade ago. Derek Lewis, again, in most of his fights, it's just like a roulette wheel. He wins by knockout, or he's going to lose a one-sided decision.
And Sergey Spivak got knocked out in 50 seconds in his UFC debut against Wal Harris. And for Sergey Spivak, he hasn't had a 5-round fight in a meaningful period of time. And even 5-round fights that he was taking when he was the champ over at WWFC, that was back in 2018, First round finish. He was really getting it done quite quickly. So surely you would think that the cardio is going to be there. And in a 5-round fight between these two guys, of course, Derek Lewis has more experience. He seems to headline at least a couple of fight night cards a year, if not a pay-per-view thrown in the mix as well. But for Spivak, it really is the effective grappling and how can he do it. And for Lewis, it's got to be not just the just get up mentality. It's got to be the just move forward. Because if you watch the fight that Spivak had against Aspinall, Aspinall closed the gap really quickly, hit Spivak. Spivak didn't really respond to those shots very well, and then he found himself on the mat finished.
The only difference between those two guys is Tom Aspinall throws shots straight, whereas Derek Lewis does loop his. So I do think Tom Aspinall's a more difficult fighter just to deal with the striking defense. Not that Derek Lewis doesn't probably hit harder for one punch sake, but I do think with Lewis, yes, if you get hit, the consequences are more dire, but at least you're more evasive because they are more available to see just because he throws them with so much power.
Lewis's other big fight night main event that he had and a big win that was in the apex, his fight against Alexei Olenek. Both these guys with wins over Olenek. When you're fighting close and near the top, you're going to fight some of the same guys. Wow. We have a look at the odds in the matchup. Lewis opened a slight favorite, minus 115. He's a plus 157 underdog right now. For Spivak, open minus 105, minus 191. Matt, this is one of those fights where we really do have to throw it out to the Fight Night Picks fans. And you guys really do a great job. We throw these out there to you in the community tab every single gosh darn week. We threw it out there to you this week. 54% of you going with Spivak to get the win. We throw it on over to the comments. AirDog saying, I think Spivak will win, but that Lewis KO TKO prop is going to be hard to stay away from. Nomad Gladiator, Spivak's well-rounded, dangerous. I could see him either tiring Lewis out or getting the knockout, or he gets knocked out in either rounds, throwing out every possibility. Bill saying Lewis is on a free fall down the rankings, so it's looking tough there. And I'll say JB Betts, Spivak beat Ty and Ty beat Derek, so my MMA math is mathin'. So yeah, it seems like, again, 54% of the fans have Spivak. About 54% had Adesanya last weekend, and that ended up crazy. So in this matchup, Matt, out of all of the possibilities, Lewis,
by submission, I doubt it's going to happen. I think that's fair to say. I don't think he's going to get a rear naked choke.
Yeah, and I mean, you had that big brother cradle there from Olenek in the fight that he had, and then he was able to get out, and he ends up finishing Olenek. But at a certain point, I do think this is the fight that Sergey Spivak's going to win that gives him the name. And for me, if he goes out and grapples early and often, he should be able to get it done against Lewis.
I agree with you, but it is really difficult to predict any Derek Lewis fight because it's always, hey, he's less skilled than his opponent,
look at Derek Lewis's last two fights. Or last three losses, let's say that. Sotogon, technical with power. Then you go to the next one, Tai Tuivasa, walks
incredible
forward.
Power.
The elbows and the shots where he had Lewis behind the black line that's around the outside of the octagon. Lewis really struggled back there, and then Pavlovich just walked him down and knocked him out. So Spivak is not that fighter, and Lewis has beaten grapplers in the past, surely. So this is a really tough one for Spivak, though.
We're going to look dumb AF, though, because I agree with you. I have Spivak to win, but if he doesn't, it's going to be like a hellacious KO like we saw Derek Lewis against Curtis Blaydes.
Or Travis Brown.
Like, Curtis Blaydes is a better wrestler than Sergey Spivak. I don't think he's as effective of a grappler once it hits the mat that Curtis Blaydes who fought Alistair Overeem. I wish we could see him more often, but you get what I mean. I would say his initial wrestling is a little bit more effective, whereas Spivak can do more once it hits the mat, though, and I think he will be able to make use of the time once it does get down. Like I said, I like the ground and pound that he's able to use, which is something Alexei Olenek wasn't using. Olenek just went for the submissions, and then when he didn't get it, there wasn't much that he was able to really accumulate, whereas Spivak, I think he will land some of those elbows and be able to cut up Lewis.
So both of us with the Spivak pick, and I mean, coming up later on this week, you have question mark kicks. We're live 2 hours before the prelims. We offer up those final picks and predictions. You get the, the look at the weigh-ins, and last weekend it was weird because two fighters missed weight, Trezano and Spann, and they both won their fights.
And Pereira came in at the last second too.
Wild stuff. 13 fights on this card, and then it's a little bit of a break. I'm going on vacation, so it's going to be a little bit of an odd one. Your next card after this is Fight Night Thompson versus Holland, and that's December 3rd. So a little bit of a time away for everybody.
There is. Enjoy it, guys. We've earned it.
Listen, 2 hours before the prelims, question mark kicks. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.